Economic Growth Committee. Good morning, members. Good morning, Senator Mattson.
Morning.
So, members, just a housekeeping and logistics here. My sense, I'm just going to guess that there's a lot of people here for Senator Dame's bill, which is fine, and we welcome any and all guests, but we're not going to take that up before 11:45. So,
what time?
You're welcome to stay with us for
11:45.
11:45.
You're giving 15 minutes for that bill?
No, sir. We go till 12:45.
Oh, okay.
So we're going through on either side of session, Senator Tomasoni. What we wanted to do at the front end of this committee, starting with Senator Rosen, was focus on kind of small business, the angel tax, the entrepreneurial venture capitalist piece of what we need to do to make Minnesota more attractive to small business. So we will take up Senator Dame's legislation. I'm not sure if you need to I don't know if there's a big demand for the seats, but appreciate those of you who are here for that bill, but it's number 6 or 7 on our list of 6 or 7. So let's move then directly to Senate File 1999, Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen, thank you for coming. Welcome to the Jobs Committee.
It's very nice to be in front of your committee, Mr. Chair and members. It's always good to have a good jobs bill out there. And that's what this is, the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority bill of $10 million appropriated from the general fund. And this, I just want to step back for a minute, Mr. Chair and members, and talk about the initiative and the push that has been going on for several years. And it actually started, well, it's been going on for quite a while, but I was, along with Senator Kelly and at that time Representative Doug Magnus and Representative Tim Mahoney, we were put on to the Governor Pawlenty's Bioscience Council. And I brought this book along to show you what we had to go through, what we were charged with back in 2003 to figure out what the bioscience industry was and what it looked like in Minnesota. We had not a clue. And, of course, it includes manufacturing, agricultural, and, of course, our very important medical science industry. So I keep this, and actually Senator Magnus just stopped at my office, and he's like, oh, I just love this book because it was just groundbreaking. And from there, we have the high-tech industry, we have the BioAlliance, we have all these partnerships that have been created, and we have this momentum in this state, and we have to continue supporting the industry that's already in the state and hopefully attracts more. This $10 million is going to help with the young startup companies that want to come here because we have the intellectual property here. We have the groundbreaking technology here. We just have to help them along. And as you said, Mr. Chair, the Angel Investment Tax Credit, all the other initiatives that we have supported, the nano technology building at the U of M, that was extremely important last year. And so it's kind of one of the tools. This $10 million is going to be very important. It's one of the tools. It's kind of holding the hands for these small companies when they're trying to apply for federal grants or filling out forms. It's kind of a one-stop shop. And there is a handout, members. And just if I can point you to this little wheel here, it talks about required to deliver the $10 million in 2012. The Technology Development Fund leverages a 1-to-6 on commercial matching funds. The business, the little red slot, and entrepreneurial accelerator of $2 million is for small scientists and engineering firms. The green of $10 million is federal assistant expansion leverage 1-to-6. And the science tech experience is for the internship program of 1.7, and that helps us build that intellectual capacity. And with me, I have two testifiers today. Mr. Chair, I have Rick King from Thomson Reuters with me and Jim Stice with Twin Cities Medical.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Mr. King, welcome to the Jobs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to you and good morning to the committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to speak in favor of this bill this morning. My name is Rick King. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Technology at Thomson Reuters, and I'm active in the community as well as a member on the advisory board of the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority, which comprises technology professionals from academia, private business, and nonprofit. We're working diligently to support the creation of new technology-based jobs in Minnesota. So as I said, I'm here to testify in favor of Senate File 1999, which requests funding of $10 million to ensure tech-based jobs have a chance to grow even more here in our state. Did you know that adding one job in the high-tech sector actually generates four additional jobs beyond? It's in that spirit that I'm here representing Thomson Reuters, the profession of technology, and thousands of Minnesotans who are seeing the writing on the wall that Minnesota is falling far behind other states in the nation in funding science, technology, engineering, and math, also known as STEM-type job growth, and we have a chance to regain our spot at the top of the list. Before I address the specific topics before the committee today, I think it might be helpful to paint you a picture of the current state of technology jobs in Minnesota. In 2010, the science and technology job sector in the U.S. grew about 2%. During the same period, Minnesota's science and technology sector shrank 1.2%. Minnesota is 42nd in the nation when it comes to entrepreneurial activity. So it shouldn't be surprising to you that our neighboring states are investing in technology growth at pretty remarkable rates. Wisconsin spent $150 million for the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery and is spending $185 million on venture capital. Iowa spent $100 million for renewable energy clean tech research, $50 million for gap funding, and $45 million for technology commercialization. Nebraska spent $3 million for an intern programship. As a technologist, these numbers worry me more than I can tell you. As an executive with nearly 200 open technology positions that we're having a hard time filling here in Minnesota, it is in our best interest to strongly support the improvement of our current rankings and to grow STEM jobs. The Minnesota Science and Technology Authority is the state's strongest advocate. Born out of Senate Bill 3014 in 2010, the authority researched and recommended a plan that will help industry and research institutions create 30 to 45,000 direct jobs and at least 100,000 indirect jobs over a 10-year period, and leverage at least $6 of federal, private, and philanthropic funding for every dollar the state invests. At our business, Thomson Reuters, we employ 55,000 people worldwide, 7,500 of whom work right here in Minnesota, 1,800 of those are in technology. And by the way, we have 12,000 technology positions worldwide. We look at technology as the lifeblood of our products and our services. It's more or less the cardiovascular system of our company. Everything that gets delivered to our customers is delivered via technology. And in fact, this is quite true today in all of the different sectors in Minnesota business and industry. There isn't one that doesn't have a strong technology component today, even the ones that you don't think of, forestry, agriculture, and so forth. They're all involved in that. We believe that we have some of the strongest and brightest minds in the world working at our business, but it's only sustainable if we have access to technology talent. Thomson Reuters, our communities, and the state of Minnesota see mutual benefit for a robust-based entrepreneurial community by encouraging, supporting technology startups, and we're delivering innovation and growth there on a silver platter. You might recall hearing about Compellent Technologies, a data storage startup out of Eden Prairie that was acquired last year by Dell. Compellent employed nearly 1,000 technologists, and upon the completion of the deal, its CEO, Phil Soren, and many other Minnesotans made a substantial profit and rolled it back into other startups around the area. And in fact, Mr. Soren himself is a perfect example, as he started another company before that called Zyotech Corporation, which was acquired by Seagate in 2000. This cycle of starting a company, selling a company, and reinvesting the money and the proceeds in the state continues with an example such as his. Today, a lot of offshoots of those two corporations have started up their own companies and their own businesses in our state, and we want them to do it in our state. Now, imagine if Minnesota could claim even 10 more people like that. What impact would it have on our economy and our future? This growth is contagious, and these successes will attract others. keeping our state growing. By supporting initiatives like the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority, we are showing entrepreneurs, innovators, and technologists that Minnesota is committed to the future. We're also demonstrating to those outside Minnesota that we are dedicated to providing a welcoming and nurturing climate for science and technology companies. It shows that Minnesota works to promote and develop a rich technology infrastructure. With the funding, the Science and Technology Authority created, the funding that they got before, created the SciTech Experience internship program that connects small businesses in Minnesota with talented technology students, giving students access to real world and the business access to top technology students, a sound platform for growth. Document here that I have shows that many of you at this table on the committee, in fact, have students that are constituents in your district who have applied for this internship program themselves. Thomson Reuters can't take advantage of the programs that are being done by the Science and Technology Authority because we're a big business. So I'm not here to promote it in any kind of self-interest. What I'm talking about here is a huge reward for the success that we get from the success and the committing of a financial support from the state to the high-tech environment in the state. For example, when these students compete and they have real work experiences under their belt, we definitely will have jobs waiting for them, and we can keep the bright minds here where they belong. Jobs that we currently can't fill, jobs that pay significantly higher salaries than others, jobs that support the kind of infrastructure we have. Also currently funded is the SBIR-STTR commercialization plan, which Jim Stice will be discussing a little more about shortly. And that will support 17 small businesses in completing their commercialization plan for federal funding. This has the potential for $1 million for each company in terms of the funding. $10 million in funding for fiscal year 2013 would support additional internships, technology matching grants, enhanced support, and funding to match federal SBIR and STTR awards, and a business accelerator to support successful management and future growth of the companies. These programs were developed and incorporated into the strategic plan that the authority put together. The bottom line is that other states are moving forward, leaving us behind. We have an opportunity to prove to the citizens, businesses, and students of Minnesota that we are serious about the future, serious about job growth, and serious about innovation. In closing, I really support this bill and believe that the state should take advantage of the work, relationships, and passion the members of the Minnesota Science and Technology Authority have invested in the development of our comprehensive and holistic technology strategy. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. King. Mr. Stice?
Chair Michelle and members, I'm president of Twin Star Medical, and my last 25 years work experience has been a founder of medical device startups, and my most recent focus has been Twin Star Medical. I'll be sharing with you Twin Star Medical's SBIR experience. It's relevant in the sense that SBIR has been a key element of Twin Star's success to date and has provided about $8 million in funding to Twin Star. We spent most of this money on developing two different devices, which I'll just spend a little bit of time on, without the blood, drainage catheters and infusion catheters. The first one is actually a drainage catheter, removes fluid, swollen tissue, you put it into the tissue, you remove the fluid. This is important. I mean, you get a bruise, you really don't worry about it too much, but if you have a leg fracture, you can get a thing called compartment syndrome, and to solve that, they put an incision about this long on both sides of your legs, 12 inches. And by use of our catheter, we hope to prevent that kind of surgery. Within brain injury, it's typically not the knock on the head that kills you or really causes its damage. It's the secondary swelling. And to relieve that pressure, they typically will sometimes do a partial skull removal. And we believe our catheter can help prevent those kinds of invasive surgery. The same catheter can be used as an infusion catheter, and we're developing that to deliver drugs directly into tumors. We've been working on brain tumors, where the current standard of care today is actually to surgically remove the tumors. We would just put the catheter in the tumor and infuse the drug. Same thing could be done for prostate cancer. Rather than removing the prostate, you could just deliver drugs directly to the prostate. In terms of our product status, we have one product launch. We have four clinical trials going, and we have multiple sort of preclinical projects in all these different areas. There have been some derivative sort of events as well as accomplishments from this SBIR funding. We've had about $10 million in Army funding, and we've had about $2 million in private equity funding for about total funding of $20 million. We have ongoing grant submissions of about $15 million in review. We have 10 patents and multiple applications pending. We have 10 employees. We have an average salary of about $80,000 per employee. Last year, we spent about $1 million in subcontracting with Minnesota suppliers, maybe legal, maybe engineering talent.
It's
a big deal. So as I look into the future here, and given sort of the climate for early stage medical device funding, I believe SBIR will continue to be a critical aspect of our adding new products and finding commercialization financing. One of the programs that we're evaluating, as we've talked about what other states do have, Kentucky does have a matching grant program for SBIR. You can get up to like $1 million for five projects. So that's about $5 million of potential availability, and we're evaluating that for our drug delivery program. We also have a seed financing program, let's say $1 million to $1.5 million. So quickly in closing, I would just say that the authority has been helpful to Twin Star, and its SBIR program has facilitated us with training, peer group mentoring, and consultant support, about $10,000 that was integral to getting a $3 million grant from NIH. And I continue to support the authority's efforts to support other small companies' success in the SBIR program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stice, and good luck with the products and the trials that you're going through now. Appreciate what you're doing. And Mr. King, thank you for what you're doing, both with your corporate title and as well as your personal time. Senator Rosen, I know there's a lot of bipartisan support for this. We're having a little trouble figuring out how and when to pay for it, but what I think what the committee would like to do, I was just talking with Senator Metzen about this, I'd like to lay this over. And we're going to try to build something a little larger that this could be a part of. And Senator Rosen, it might not be fair to ask you, but I don't think this was a part of the governor's supplemental that was announced yesterday, was it?
I do not believe it was.
I'm seeing head shakes, so no. So we're going to we're going to have to do some more fine-tuning on the arithmetic. But Senator Rosen, any concluding comments?
Well, yes, thank you. And I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and for many of you on this committee that have worked on these issues. And this agenda, obviously, is geared toward it today, is that we have made an investment in these in our strong bioscience, our strong industries that are already in place. And you need to prioritize, as your committee here, Mr. Chair, and all these great members here, what is important to invest and build up and make sure that we keep moving in the right direction. I think this is a very good a very good investment. We've got the partnerships in place, and we've got the technology. Obviously, we just need to keep this momentum going, and you'll see the dividends pay off, obviously, in the future. So I really appreciate your indulgence.
Senator Metzen, did I see your hand up?
No, Mr. Chairman, but I applaud Senator Rosen for bringing this forward. My sidebar conversation with you was, Mr. Chairman, was and maybe Mr. Jensen can answer this. I mean, the appropriation is for 2013, and I'm not sure we can bind another future legislature to this money. I mean, I'm for it, and I'd like to see this part of the package, but that's my question is, we might not, you know, it's a different group next year, and you know, I think we should send a message now to the community so they know we're interested and we want to do it, but that's kind of my question.
Mr. Jensen?
Mr. Chairman and members, the way this is written, the $10 million would go into fiscal year 13 and the budgeting process would assume that's in the base for 14 and 15. So it would come back next session as a base number of $20 million.
Right.
If we were able to identify the $10 million this year.
Mr. Chairman, that's right. And if you wanted to approve it next session.
Well, Senator Metzen, let's keep working on that.
That's
Senator,
yeah, it's a work in progress.
Yep. Senator Torres-Rain.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for both Mr. King and Mr. Stice. This is an area, Senator Rosen, that I am paying attention to as I advocate for inclusion and growth of business and minority communities, in part because I think we've put a lot of emphasis into training and getting people into the construction business, and we're in trouble in that we're not investing enough in infrastructure. So we have competing efforts coming in. So my question to the witness is, in your view, have we made progress in terms of investing and growing the numbers of entrepreneurs of color, minority entrepreneurs and women, both in startup kind of efforts or the commercialization and expansion of existing business? And could you give me a kind of a brief overview of those efforts and whether or not you feel we're making any progress?
Mr. King.
Mr. Chair, Senator, very good question. It would be my observation that as the general status lags somewhat behind other states, we lag behind in the areas that you asked as well, and that these funds would help us to uncover those startups, those entrepreneurs, based on, you know, diverse gender, diverse race, backgrounds, and so forth, so we can encourage a lot more activity, both among the minority groups, but also just in general in the small business communities. This would help people, I think, considerably.
And, Mr. Chair, obviously, we recognize that that is a very important part of the workforce going forward for this state, and so we should be looking at this diverse workforce.
Thank you,
Senator Rosen. So we'll keep working
Thank
on this
you.
With you. So we'll lay over Senate File 1999. Thank you, Mr. King, Mr. Stice, and Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Really appreciate this time.
Members, will move to Senate File 2390, Senator Chamberlain. Anything different? And I have Mr. Mandel. Mandel, I want to get that right.
Mandel,
gotcha. So, Senator Chamberlain, welcome to the Jobs Committee, Senate File 2390. Again, kind of continuing with the theme of small business and startup and what do we need to do to attract those who are ready to invest at what we hope is the end of a recession here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Before we start, would you care to take care of the amendment, author's amendment?
Well, let's pass that out first, Senator Chamberlain, before you get to that. So members, we're passing out the A1. Members, just a little background then. So our intent would be to hear this bill this morning and then move it to the tax committee because it's clearly a tax bill. So Senator Chamberlain, the A1 is to put it into the format that you and those pushing this prefer.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Members, let's as an author's amendment, then I'll move the A1 for Senator Chamberlain. Does everyone have a copy of that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. So the A1 is adopted. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to have the opportunity to bring this bill forward. some smart people came up with a great idea, and they're bringing it forward here. Not me, but other smart people. But it's a good idea, and it's really. I hope you'll like it. I think you will. This committee and the 2012 legislature's top priority is to find ways to help facilitate the increase of jobs in our state. We have talked a great deal about the need to improve Minnesota's economic climate. I am pleased, as I said, to bring you an initiative that will do that. Senate File 2390 is designed to assist emerging technology and biotechnology companies to transfer or sell their unused Minnesota new net operating loss carryforwards for cash. Profitable companies paying Minnesota corporate tax can buy these credits at a discount, thereby reducing their state tax obligation. This program, which other states have, New Jersey, and my testifiers will go into more detail about that, provides early-stage companies with infusions of operating capital to accelerate their path to profitability without having to seek additional debt or equity financing, and allows larger companies to fund those early-stage companies by participating in an NOL credit marketplace. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Mandel, and he'll go in a little more detail.
Mr. Mandel, welcome to the Jobs Committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Shay Mandel, and I am Vice President for Government Relations with Life Science Alley. Members of the committee, quickly, Life Science Alley, as I'm sure most of you know, is actually the largest state-based life sciences organization in the nation. We represent 680 organizations from startups to mid-stage to large companies in the bio and life sciences, including our research institutions such as Mayo and the University of Minnesota. So I'm here today on behalf, I think, of the entire life sciences ecosystem here in Minnesota, which, as you all know, is a unique ecosystem and one in which very few states have the opportunity to benefit from. Senator Chamberlain mentioned some really smart people, and those really smart people are the job creators and the entrepreneurs here in Minnesota that are in the process of developing drugs, therapeutics, and devices that will allow all of us to live longer and more productive lives. New Jersey is the only other state that has something similar to this. And New Jersey has a unique asset, just as we do, in that the predominant base of the pharmaceutical industry is in New Jersey. I'd like to characterize this bill for you as an opportunity for Minnesota to respond and protect the critical asset in the face of what today is an incredibly uncertain and chaotic regulatory environment. So what we have in Minnesota that nobody else has is a lot of companies that are working on a next-generation therapeutic device. And so the ideas created, the research has been transferred from the U or created, you know, as in another company. And so we've got intellectual property, but now we need to make that marketable. And the way you do that, as you all know, is you hire a lot of smart people. You do a lot of research. The FDA puts you through the process of, you know, multiple aspects of clinical trials until ultimately the FDA approves your product. Well, that environment looks a lot different today than it did just 3 or 4 years ago. The lengths of time it takes to approve a product today have grown dramatically. Our organization's actually just partnered with the FDA to try and make some headway on this. But so envision a CEO and a group of entrepreneurs and investors getting together and working on that next generation therapy and looking at 3, 4, 5 years of a business plan and several millions, maybe even $100 million in investment to get there. And now we're 3 or 4 years downstream. The clinical trial's been changed by the FDA. The timetable's been extended, and you've got CEOs going back to investors and saying, you know, I need a couple more scientists, or I need to save a couple of scientists, and I need more money. So this isn't about how do we better compete with another state. This is about making sure that Minnesota keeps a really unique asset by allowing those companies that are intended to burn money. So we would all agree a business that loses money for several years, maybe the marketplace is saying that's not a good business. In this environment, what we're talking about are companies that have to spend 3 to 5 years burning a lot of money to get through the FDA approval process. And so in a state like New Jersey, where they have the same issue, they put this plan in place in 2009. New Jersey let $34 million in NOL carry forward tax credits out, and that resulted in more than $500 million of new investment into those businesses and other businesses. So there is some precedent for doing this around that unique sort of environment, and we have it here in Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you or the committee members have.
Mr. Mandel, just something that kind of sticking in me is how does, other than the 2009 legislation that you cited, how does New Jersey kind of, how do they develop their brand in this particular industry, in this particular market? We win and we lose to other states all the time, but New Jersey, I don't think we should lose to them very often.
Well, Mr. Chair, New Jersey, you know, I think within the industry, one of the things that I know we struggle with here in Minnesota and most states do is how we most appropriately brand some of our key assets. And we obviously have a very diverse economy, diverse citizenry here, so it's hard to focus in one area. But certainly around the world, Minnesota is looked to as one of the key medical device foundational communities and states around the world. So we regularly at our organization, we have visitors from around the world, countries like China, Japan, Germany, that are interested in the medical device industry, and they come looking for expertise here in Minnesota, especially in the cardiovascular and implantable devices. I mean, this really is ground zero, so to speak, of that activity. And so what we're talking about here is ensuring that that continues to be the case. New Jersey, because of their concentration of large pharmaceutical companies, has really been able to steal that brand. But to your point, I think certainly losing any contest with New Jersey is not something any state would necessarily want to be involved in. And as it relates to pharmaceuticals, I'd love to share with this committee that actually the pharmaceutical industry here in Minnesota is the fastest growing sector of our life sciences community. So over the last 5 or 6 years, the pharmaceutical industry and the jobs created from that industry in the state have increased by 77%. So we're actually in a position to gain some pharmaceutical jobs in addition to helping to save our med device and med tech jobs with this legislation. And so this would allow for other companies in New Jersey that are interested in taking advantage of the growing talent pool in Minnesota to be on even par if we put this legislation in place.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think if I understand this bill, the idea is that if one of these high-tech companies experiences a net operating loss, that they can sell their net operating loss to a bigger company who would give them the amount of money that they've lost in exchange for a tax credit in a reduced amount of what they would have paid for the loss. And I'm looking at clause 3 on page 3 on line 325, and so I just want to see if anybody can explain it to me, because it says an eligible applicant with more than $250,000 of transferable tax benefits is authorized to surrender additional transferable tax benefits determined by multiplying the applicant's transferable tax benefits less the minimum transferable tax benefits that the corporation is authorized to surrender under Clause 2 by a fraction, the numerator of which is the total amount of transferable tax benefits that the commissioner is authorized to approve less the total amount of transferable tax benefits approved.
What's your question?
The denominator of which is the total transferable tax benefits required to be surrendered by all eligible applicants less the total amount of transferable tax benefits approved under Clause 1 and 2. My question is, what is the maximum amount? Or the minimum amount that somebody might qualify for.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, the maximum amount that can be issued out by the DOR in any particular year is $60
million.
And what you're I just did the calculation on that, by the way, so I went through that and I did some fictional numbers and to make sure I got the right numerator and denominator, and I think I did. But the maximum amount any year is $60 million. But clause one and two, smaller companies that are smaller get the full benefit. Clause two, companies that are medium sized, they get at least $250,000, and then they can get up some more than that. And then Clause 3 is dealing with what this whole thing is, the 1, 2, and 3 are dealing with are if you've reached the, if you're getting to that maximum amount, how are you going to allocate these benefits out? So that's what this formula does. If you get to near $60 million, first you take the low ones, then you take the medium one, then you take the big ones, and you have to find have a formula to properly apportion it out so you don't exceed $60 million. So the Clause 3 is just helping to make sure you don't exceed the $60 million, if I haven't missed something on that. And so that's the calculation to do that. So the cap is always going to be $60 million, but you give the first benefit to the smaller companies, then the medium company, and then the larger company. Everybody will get at least $250,000. I believe that's how that will go.
Correct.
Mr. Mandel, did you have something you were going to add to the Tomasoni question?
Mr. Chair, the only thing I would add is in the bill there is also a lifetime cap per company, which is $15 million. So I would just point that out as well. But I think Senator Chamberlain's walked us
through. So a lifetime cap to the company that is experiencing a net operating loss or to the one paying the credit?
Correct. That's experienced the loss.
Net operating loss. And so this is a first-in, first-out type of bill? My question is, you said the smaller companies will get the $250,000 first, but what if a bigger company applies before the smaller company does? Your witness knows this.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, let's see if I can get that right. That's a good question. Everybody will get at least $250,000, and can you help me out? If a large company came in first, would they get everything?
Mr. Chair and Senator, the eligible companies for this fit into a category with under 250 employees, and they're operating on losses. So these are companies that all fit into the small and emerging business category. So this isn't about Medtronic, for example, playing in this space at all. What the allocation does is it requires companies, as they're surrendering their net operating losses, that if they have at least that 250, to just surrender them all, come into the pot. And then, as Senator Chamberlain appropriately mentions, there is a formula, and I would love to get a little more specificity on exactly how that would work, because I don't think I can answer your question specifically today in terms of if we drew out the hypothetical and had roughly $70 million in tax credits, exactly how at the end that would be apportioned, but I can get that answer for you and would love to do that.
And Mr. Chairman,
Tomasoni.
Medtronic could end up being a player, though, because they could be the ones that end up buying the tax credit from the smaller company, right?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. So the tax credits that would be purchased by companies with a Minnesota tax liability could certainly be Medtronic. It could be any company with a tax liability. What this bill is intended to do is to create cash infusions for companies that are currently burning cash to get to that approval within the FDA or solve that clinical issue. So there is a tax benefit, or at least there's a cash benefit to the purchasers of the tax credits in that they're buying tax credits at a slight discount, so they're lowering their taxable liability here in Minnesota with the tax credits. And that could be – that doesn't have to be Medtronic. So there's no biotechnology requirement that the purchasers of credits would fall into, but the companies that were allowing to carry forward and surrender their net operating losses for cash – are those companies that only fit into that category where the business models themselves require them to lose significant amounts of money for a period of time.
And Mr. Chairman, one final question. Is it 80% the discount rate on the people who buy the credit?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, that is the floor that we've set. So what this creates is tax credits that can be purchased, which creates its own marketplace. That is the floor of what they can be purchased for. But if there are multiple players trying to purchase tax credits, we anticipate the purchase of those tax credits, again, the more players, and that's why we didn't just draw this to specific companies, will be higher. But that's the floor.
So there could be bidding going on for these tax credits.
There should be. That's our intent, sir.
Senator Kelat.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain, where did the $60 million rationale come from? How did that number come up? The testifier said $34 million and New Jersey was sufficient to generate a lot of activity.
Senator Chamberlain?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kielash, the legislation pretty much follows the New Jersey model. It was working there, so the House folks took that model. That's pretty much what this follows, except with the exception of the 75%. New Jersey had 80%. We go to 75%. That makes us a little more competitive. We don't have to – the companies that are here don't have to bid as high to get that. They can bid a little bit lower. As far as the $60 million, again, that's a New Jersey number. But $60 million would be the apportioned number. So essentially, if you were a company and you had $1 million of taxable adjusted income before apportionment, your apportionment was 10%, you get $100,000. It's the $100,000 that you get to transfer. That's the credit. So the $60 million essentially will transfer to $600 million in that scenario.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain, I'm just wondering why it's $60 million instead of $50 or $34 or $80 or $100. Is there some rationale for that number that we're using here?
Yes, there is. Mr. Mandel?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, as Senator Chamberlain points out, because New Jersey is the one state in the nation that has this legislation, and you know they're only a couple years into it, so the full experience is one in which data isn't perfectly available for. This is what New Jersey did. They put $60 million in credit opportunity in their legislation. In 2009, the first year and the only year that we have good data from, $34 million of those credits were accessed. So the process in New Jersey and the one in which we would anticipate here, first step in the process is deed would be required to certify the companies that we're talking about to make sure they fit into the category that we've described. And then looking at those losses and how much there is, where we fall into that. 60, I think, is a good starting point for us. Obviously, if there are less tax credits accessed, that's less allocation for the state. But one of the differences between our industries here, again, predominantly that med tech and therapeutics as opposed to New Jersey, there are a lot more players in this marketplace. So the number of companies we have that would fit into this category is a significantly larger number of companies. We actually have significantly more employees here in Minnesota that are playing in the med tech and therapeutic space than New Jersey does in the pharma. So the answer is we mirrored New Jersey's because there isn't a great model yet with lots of data for us to pick a different number. But we also think there's a difference in that there are more jobs here and more companies, and we might be able to consume it. But that is the data on New Jersey.
And just one more follow-up, and that is it's hard for me to tell who's deciding whether or not the companies that have the net operating losses are really viable, and so that is this a I guess what I'm concerned about is that is the company that's doing the investment in that company predicting that they're going to be successful or that their technology or their whatever they're trying to develop is actually viable? Is that who's doing that judgment so that we're not giving tax credits to somebody that is not viable, would have gone out of business except for selling his tax losses, and will never come up with a viable product that creates a job in Minnesota? How's that judgment being done?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, it's in the bill here, there's, I think it's page 2, it talks about what an eligible company is, the definitions of those companies, biotech, emerging, new and emerging, expanding companies and technology companies, and the Commissioner of Deed as well as the Commissioner of DOR are instructed to work together to develop a process and program to qualify these companies. And when a company, before a company transfers its NOL and sells it, they have to get a certificate from the DOR Deed, and then they're authorized to do that. So it would go through Deed and DOR to make sure they have a process and they're eligible companies and fit this matter. But, of course, there's no guarantee that they won't go bankrupt. But, of course, that would be in the market as well. A company that wants to buy those credits, they'd they do their due diligence to make sure that before that, and they're required to sign an agreement with them as well for the before they take the credit. So it goes with deed and DOR. They vet it. They issue a certificate, and then when the certificate is issued to the buyer, they have to sign an agreement saying, stating a few things.
Thanks.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain. So as I understand this bill, one of the largest assets sometimes a company, a startup company, might have is this operating loss carry forward. So this is a section of their equity on their balance sheet that in the past has been inaccessible, that sits there until they have a profit sometime in the future. And what this does is it frees up that capital, both for the corporation that's purchasing it, but also for the company that is that has the net operating loss. So the fiscal note states that the full impact of the bill is $60 million. That is potentially what is at risk or exposed for the state. However, it really, as I understand it, isn't at law. It isn't a loss to the state. It's moving it forward, because once these companies, going to Senator Kelash's question, once these companies turn profitable, they will utilize these credits at that point. So what this does, it accelerates the usage of those tax loss carryforwards and brings them into the market, so we can free up the capital to keep these marginal companies in business today. Hopefully they can continue to invest in product, in jobs, in technology to be profitable at a rapid pace versus having to wait until they do that through other means. So to me, the fiscal note shows a larger impact than potentially we really have, because it's really just bringing that forward, something that will be spent over a longer period of time. Would that be fair?
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lilly, fiscal note, those nasty little fiscal notes. Part of the great insight of this legislation is simply that you're right. If they weren't able to sell those NOLs, they'd sit on their balance sheet as a deferred tax benefit to be used in the future. So they'd be using them in 5 or 10 years if the company stayed in business and then became profitable. What they're doing now is they sell them, and they'll bring those losses up forward. So, yes, that's exactly how that would work. And I see there's a dynamic effect here. You give cash infusion to a company, they stay in business, they grow their business, they start transacting business, and you're throwing off revenue that way as well. And so there's a dynamic effect. And the $60 million is the conservative estimate that I would agree that the DOR would probably have to do, because if everybody did it, we'd have $60 million this year. But then there's an offsetting dynamic with generating income and revenue from that company that has stayed in business and still working and still operating.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a great concept. The issue I have is it encourages the tax avoidance game. I mean, it encourages that. And it makes our system more complicated, not less complicated. I think Senator Kelash brought out a good point. I think the concern is as individuals, if you have a significant loss, you can't sell that to somebody else. You can, especially like in the stock market, you've got an X amount you can use carrying forward. I know, I get to carry forward some losses that I sustained, but I don't get to sell them to somebody else. And it makes our system somewhat more complicated. And that's, does somebody go into the business just to sell these credits? I know the business isn't viable, but the end game might be that I can sell those credits to somebody. And I just, personally, I think there's got to be a better way that we encourage investments in these businesses, because to me, it complicates the system. And I know we had a chance to visit yesterday, and I certainly want to support the industry, but I'm just concerned about what this does to the system.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chamberlain, I'm not interested in muddying up this bill, but the question I had just quickly is this: I mean, could this be transferable to other businesses? I'm not in the technology or biotechnology business. I manufacture concrete block. You know, and really since January of 2008, I've had over 130 customers file for bankruptcy, and every one of them had a net operating loss, I would say, easily for 12 to 18 months before they filed for bankruptcy. And so the question is, I mean, could this be transferred to other industries, or is it, in your mind, you know, with your accounting background and expertise, is that possible or not?
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I would think that as a pilot project, eventually this, I think I don't see why it couldn't eventually do that sort of thing. I mean, you know, eventually all you're just taking these losses and trading them, and eventually the state's going to collect taxes on something. So I think there's a benefit across for all businesses eventually if we could do something like that. But of course, you know, starting this up, you ramp up and get the DOR and deed to work into a process and a program, learning curve, and then I think eventually, yes, Senator Peterson, I think it's be a perfect idea. Why not?
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chamberlain, I want to applaud you for this bill. I think it's a great bill. It has it's a win all the way around, infusing cash into the startups in these fields particularly that do have that long time frame, and also these are the growing industries. So I think it's really important to focus on that, and you know, making, to Senator Howe's point, I think making our existing businesses have a more favorable tax climate is a good thing. And if selling these NOLs does that, I think that's a good thing. Although I do agree that our tax code is in dire need of some reformation. But at this point, this is the beast that we have, and I think that this is a good way to work within the system that we have. So congratulations. It's a great bill, I think.
Thanks. Senator Thomasoni, and then we're going to move this to taxes where some more of this discussion will take place.
A couple of questions, because you definitely had some slippery slope arguments here just from a couple of your own members, which were pretty interesting. But I have a question about the effective dates. The effective dates say that it's for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2011. So does that mean that if the governor signs this bill into law, that it becomes effective immediately, or that it becomes effective on August 1st, like all other bills that don't have effective dates?
Is that for council?
Somebody who can tell me the answer to that question, first of all. And the second question is, since we talked about the $10 million in the last bill being $20 million, this is really $120 million, right? Or is this a one-time $60 million?
Mr. Chair,
Senator
and Senator Thomas, it would be effective for tax year 2012. So those companies, they could do these transactions as soon as the DOR had a process in place to do it. They could initiate the transactions. And your second question, Senator Thomas, I'm sorry.
So you think that this would be effective upon signature of the governor?
Yeah, for that tax year. And then the deed, pending deeds, deed and DOR coming up with that certificate process.
Can we get a clarification on that, Mr. Chairman, from the council? Because
they're going to change your vote, Senator Thompson?
No, I think it's important to know if it's effective immediately upon signature,
council.
Or if it's effective
Mr.
December.
Chair, members, and Senator Thompson, on page 5 of the bill, I think the first sections that actually kind of put the program in place with deed. On line 5.29, it does say this section is effective the day following final enactment and applies to taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2011. So the language in the program would be put in place within deed, you know, so they could begin, you know, to administer the program. But then it sounds like it would be effective for taxable years for 2012.
There's two more effective dates that don't say upon final enactment.
Mr. Chair and members and Senator Thomas, I believe then those are not really to do with starting the program within deed. So those would just have implications on the tax payments
then,
in 2012.
My second question, Senator Chamberlain, was, is this a one-time $60 million or is this a base $60 million? So would it agree to be $120 million in the next biennium?
It would
be $60 million in this biennium and then it would be carried forward? What's
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, it's $60 million per
total
year.
And it starts in this biennium, so it would
be. And of course, you know, for tax year 2012, companies and corporations are filling out their tax returns and filing them in by September of 2013, so that window.
So, which tax year would this go into, then, Mr. Chairman? But it wouldn't be in this.
Well, it would actually
start on July 1st of this next year.
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair.
Of this year, 2012.
So you get a tax year, and the companies would be filling out their tax returns. They have to make all their payments.
Well, I understand that, but
right.
I'm just trying to figure out where we budget.
So for each year, it's a maximum of $60 million. So
I got that, but it would.
Senator Tomasoni.
We go forward into the next biennium, not this, because nobody would claim it this year.
Starts fiscal year 2013. That's the clarification.
Fiscal year 2013. So.
Yeah, right. That would be correct. I'm sorry.
So thank you, Senator Chamberlain. So Senator Nelson moves that Senate file 2390 be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee, where Senator Chamberlain, you're going to have to do some more work with Senator Howe and some others. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Members will now take up the two pieces of the Angel Tax legislation, so Senate File 1774.
Ken.
All right, members, we are talking about Senate File 1774. Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could ask staff, or maybe I've missed somebody in the room here, I'm looking for Mr. Cassidy, who has a piece of this, a section of this bill as well. But members, briefly, and then let's get to the witnesses. But Senate File 1774, I think it's probably fair to describe it as kind of the next generation of on the angel tax issue. And maybe a better way to describe that is, how can we make Minnesota a place where a good idea can grow? And if a good idea can grow here, the jobs that go with it. So there's a number of sections to this bill, members, and I give great credit to, frankly, Senator Metzen and Governor Pawlenty and others who kind of began this discussion and eventual passage of some angel tax legislation. So some of this is a cleanup of that, and some of this is another step forward along those lines. So members and Senator Lilly, I'd like to have John Alexander go first. And Mr. Alexander has been a part of this walk through the legislature over a number of years, and he has both a good historical background but also a real technical knowledge of, again, how a good idea grows here in the state. So thank you for coming.
Mr. Alexander, please state your name for the record and proceed.
John Alexander. Mr. Chair, we had made a number of suggestions for the Angel Investment Tax Credit. I had understood Deed was going to give you a summary, so I'll try to put some of these in context.
Do you want to go to that?
If he's here, that would be great.
Is that a better context if you go first, Bob?
Summary of
them. Paul, why don't you skip up? Thank you. So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Alexander,
So we make sure that the story is the most understandable. We also have Bob Isaacson from Deed, who I'm told is prepared to give a little more of kind of the history, how we got here. And so thank you for being flexible. Thank you for being flexible, members.
Sorry to take you off guard.
Oh, no. I went ahead you first just because.
All right, Mr. Isaacson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Isaacson. I'm Director of Finance with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Wasn't quite prepared to prepare some comments on this bill, but let me just say something about the Angel Investment Tax Credit as a whole. The credit, by every measure, by all observers, has been a phenomenal success. In 2010, we had 67 businesses receiving investments. 2011, which we just concluded, we had 113 businesses receiving investment. In 2011, the most recent year, we issued nearly $16 million in credits, which spurred nearly $64 million in investment in small businesses in Minnesota through the Angel program. Interestingly enough, we received over 218 investments from non-Minnesotans. So we've received a lot of money from folks outside the state interested in investing in Minnesota businesses, which speaks to a large extent to the high quality of Minnesota businesses. They invested over $17 million in these businesses. Over the life of the program, we've had nearly 170 businesses and receive 180 businesses receive investment. Most of those have been in the Twin Cities area, and it's something that we've been working on over the last couple of years and trying to encourage more investment in greater Minnesota. Business types are predominantly in the biotech, software, electronics, instrumentation, and clean technology area, high-tech areas of Minnesota. All businesses that receive investment need to have some license or some proprietary technology. In this case, they've predominantly been in those four large areas. With that, I'll conclude my comments. I'll be happy to take any questions, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Isaacson.
Now we'll go back to Mr. Alexander.
Alexander.
Thank you for putting my comments in context. We've made four categories of suggested changes to the Angel Investment Tax Credit. For 2011, 12, 13, and 14, there is $12 million currently allocated in tax credits each year with a 25% tax credit. That results in $48 million of capital going into qualified companies. Last year, as a result of the rollover from the last 4 months of 2010 when this was in effect, roughly $16 million went into the companies that Bob Isaacson mentioned. As a result, $64 million of capital, you know, people took money out of their savings and other alternatives and put them into companies here. That would reduce to 48 this year. That money was spent within the first 10 and a half months of last year. And so at our current run rate, and based on the way in which the tax credit was taken down in both 2010 and 2011, the Angel Investment Tax Credit is currently structured will be out of money sometime between July and August. In addition, Wisconsin, our nearest neighbor and competitor, at least in many technologies, has increased their Angel Investment Tax Credit to $20 million. In our estimation, $20 million would be comfortable through the end of the year in terms of funding the state's needs and, and demands based on the number of companies that are going through and the run rates that we're currently seeing. So our first recommendation is to expand the legislation to an annual allotment of $20 million per year. Should I address questions as I go or after I'm done? Okay. The second addresses an impediment to companies taking Angel Investment Tax Credit and also addresses some of the concentration that we're seeing around the greater beltway. When it was first put in place, I got a long list of emails from CEOs of emerging technology companies outside the beltway saying that the wage restrictions, which were put in at a relatively late hour in the last bill, were an impediment for them taking the capital and therefore expanding their businesses. Those people who work for emerging technology companies usually do take a lower than normal wage if they were to work for a Control Data, a Cargill, a St. Jude Medical, because what they do get is equity. And the equity isn't worth a thing when they start with the company. But as they increase value, decrease risk for the shareholders, create a product that people want to buy, and enhance the value of the shareholders, that equity becomes worth something significant. And the minimum wage restrictions in the job right now require, order of magnitude, a minimum salary for all employees of about $40,000. And in parts of this state, $8 an hour, $10 an hour, $12 an hour is very acceptable, especially with the equity kicker associated with it. So two of our recommendations are to strike the minimum hourly wage for both full-time employees and for interns. It's worth noting this was added over the last weekend in which the bill was modified before it was passed in March of 2010, that the vast majority of the other states that have angel investment tax credit legislation do not have a minimum wage requirement. There were three changes that we recommended in order to minimize, let me use the term, gaming of the system. We found that there were some very smart people that looked at the legislation and figured out a way to use it that, in my estimation, does not speak to the spirit of the law, even though it might comply with the letter of the law. Language to prohibit investment in publicly traded companies. Language to reverse an investment if, in fact, a deal that would cause a liquidity event, a sale of the business, occurs within 6 months. And this was compromise language between us and Deed, really trying to simplify the issue. Boards of directors, senior management take quite a bit of time to structure a deal. And so it's entirely possible, and indeed we think it has occurred, where somebody knew a deal was pending, made the investment, got the 25% tax credit, and then got a liquidity event, and it didn't do anything to build a business relative to what we were trying to accomplish here. So the language has a six-month, 180-day window in which, if a deal occurs, the tax credit will be unwound. Another last-minute addition was the applicability of convertible debt. The convertible debt that's in the current legislation requires a 3-year mandatory conversion into a preferred or common stock, which is the typical security that investors put into early-stage companies. The fine-tuning of this has encouraged Deed to approve deals in which the language says convertible in 3 years, but there may also be language in there that allows it to be repaid in 1, in 6 months, in 2 years. And so you, in fact, approve a deal as the language you require, but also allows for language that violates the spirit of what we're trying to do. My personal preference is there's convertible debt has enough securities. It doesn't really need to be in this at all. But if it's in here, it ought to be mandatorily convertible within 3 years with, outside of a bankruptcy, no other early conversion or especially, I'm sorry, no other early repayment. The last is a basic information requirement. When the bill was originally drafted and then modified, the view of Deed was that information on the qualified companies beyond their name, contact information, a couple of sentences on the business, email address, website, violated privacy rules. Again, in negotiation with Deed, they are amenable to this modification so that this information would be available on the Positively Minnesota website. Those are my suggested changes. If I can answer any questions, be happy to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Alexander. Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you were talking about this, you had mentioned a couple of times in the testimony, I heard angel investment tax credit, and this is the Minnesota Small Business Investment Credit. So just for those who are tracking, knowing that there's a difference between the two, if you could just share for members and others who are following this conversation, illustrate some of the differences between the two so to distinguish the two different programs. If you could, please.
Mr. Alexander.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Senator. the part of the bill that I'm testifying for is the part of the bill that provides a 25% tax credit to those investors. Let me group them as angels, although they certainly could be other types of entities as long as they satisfy the pass-through requirement in the legislation that goes into emerging technology companies. I'm not commenting on the CAPCO part of the legislation, if that's part of your question.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, you're right. There are two pieces to this. Angel put the halo over his head, and then small business over on this side. So, and we haven't had Mr. Cassidy hasn't had a chance to go through the small business piece. I don't know if people are prepared for that now, but that would be it's kind of our order, the lineup here.
Senator Michelle, let's proceed. Mr. Cassidy, welcome to the committee. And I don't know, perhaps you should have a halo over your head also.
We'll see.
Not yet. We'll see. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street & Dyer. First, just to clarify the question from Senator Daley, the Angel Investment Tax Credit has been in law for a little less than 2 years. It was passed in April of
March of 10.
March of 10. And the Small Business Investment Tax Credit is not in law currently. This is a new proposal. It's been proposed in the legislature the last couple of years. If you allow me, I can go through this proposal and describe the legislation and the need for it. Again, Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Leonard Street & Dyer. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate File 1774, all the provisions, including the Angel provisions, and the Small Business Investment Act. Speaking today on behalf of our clients, Enhanced Capital, which is a company that has been promoting this program and implementing this program around the country. This program addresses exactly what this committee is here for, that is to create jobs and to create new revenue for the state of Minnesota. To accomplish that, we need to create some incentives in the marketplace to unlock capital, if you will, from those that have it. The economic development tool that we have before you today has a proven track record in many states, including New York, Texas, Missouri, and Wisconsin. It was recently passed in Tennessee and Connecticut, and Wisconsin is also considering expanding their program that they had passed in 1998. This is also an economic development tool that comes at a time when our economic conditions have caused credit markets to tighten. Capital is scarce for many Minnesota businesses, small businesses wishing to expand, and are hoping to take that next big step in their business cycle. That next big step can oftentimes be difficult financially because many businesses are no longer bankable in this economy. They may present a great opportunity for investment, but they may not also meet the pro forma or financial model of their local banker. And with nowhere to turn, these small companies have few options but to look at other venues such as the East and West Coast venture capital firms, look to other states for financial assistance, which means they probably would move, forego expansion altogether and thereby miss the opportunity to grow jobs and create revenue, or sell their product or idea altogether to another business, or just simply to go out of business. This proposal is fairly straightforward and has been before this committee in the past and addresses a real need in our market. The Small Business Investment Act immediately would channel $100 million to growing Minnesota small businesses so that they can expand their operations and grow jobs in our state. To accomplish this, the Act would have the Department of Economic Development license and regulate between 5 and 10 professional investment managers to go out and pool the resources of insurance companies that operate and are regulated in our state, pool those resources into a $100 million investment pool. The investment managers would then invest those funds in local growing Minnesota businesses who may be having a difficult time finding financing. The investment managers would be required by this proposal to target investments to small and medium-sized businesses with less than 100 employees that are exclusively located in the state of Minnesota. In exchange for this, the insurer providing the initial capital for the investment fund would receive a tax credit against their state premium tax obligation, the tax that they pay on premiums in the state of Minnesota, but only after meeting certain funding and other criteria and investment thresholds have been met. The tax credits don't kick in for 4 years and are targeted at Minnesota businesses. The tax credits would kick in 2016, 4 years from now, two budget cycles out. Assuming all the requirements of the legislation have been met, the tax credits would be paid out over 4 years in equal varying increments. The tax credits may be forfeited if investment managers do not invest the funds in qualified investments in a timely manner. I want to point out that no tax credits would be paid out and no profits could be taken out of this program until 100% of the funds have been put on the street and invested in small Minnesota businesses. Mr. Chairman, this proposal continues to operate in other states. It has a proven track record. Insurers have stood behind it for years. It's also being reauthorized in some states as we speak, or being considered to be reauthorized. With that, Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Senator Michelle?
Senator Lilly and members, I think that completes at least kind of a broad overview. Again, kind of three pieces here. There's some recommendations and some language working on the angel tax pieces through deed, as Mr. Isaacson as further broadened by Mr. Alexander's testimony, and then the other small business piece that Mr. Cassidy referred to. So I think that's kind of the broad overview of the three pieces. We also have another bill that Senator Lilly is carrying that we can hear next, which some of it will be duplicative, but represents the department deeds department bill for this year on the angel tax issue. So kind of sticking with the theme today.
Very good. Thank you, Senator. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cassidy, this sounds like a great bill. Actually, it kind of sounds like the CAPCO bill that Senator Howe and I authored last year with some added incentives. And so I want you to know I support this initiative greatly. But there is one question that I think you might be able to address that and that is those, I would call them contingency funds, but that insurance companies, their required reserves that are to be there in case of their liability, to for their liability needs. Is there some protection in there for consumers so that insurance companies cannot give so much of their reserves to this program so that their policyholders would be at risk? I'm sure there is. I just need you to explain that. Thank you.
Mr. Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, absolutely. First and foremost is the tax credit. The tax credit obligation will be paid back to the insurance company at a rate of 85% over 4 years. But most importantly is that the reserves of insurance companies are regulated by the state of Minnesota. Each state has an insurance commissioner. Ours happens to be the Department of Commerce. And they regulate those reserves, and they make sure that insurers are not going beyond their means and investing or taking risky investments that would bring down the reserves to the level that they need to be at. So the regulator is constantly looking at the reserves of insurance companies, and I think our chief author can attest to that, working with a life insurance company. And the insurers that we've worked with over the years are all the names that you would be very familiar with, from State Farm and Allianz and others.
It's fine.
Very good. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know what, Senator Michelle, with all the discussion about halos here, I'm starting to see some horns grow. And I don't know of anywhere in the state where $8 or $9 an hour is acceptable pay for people who are starting jobs. And when we give tax credits or taxable dollars to businesses, I would like them to be able to pay people or a living wage at least. And I'm going to have an amendment to remove that language, Mr. Chairman, or reinstate the old language of minimum wages. I thought we had some really good testimony from Dee just now saying that this program has been very successful, and maybe one of the reasons it's very successful is because we're actually paying people. And I think that you, Mr. Chairman, should want to take this language out and put it back to the way it was, because at least we can say we're creating good-paying jobs and jobs that people want to have. And I would like to hear your response, Mr. Chairman, before I make the motion, because I would definitely like to reinstate the old language.
Senator Michelle.
Senator Tomasoni, I would not agree with that direction. I'd ask you to listen to Mr. Alexander and kind of the experience that we've had over the last couple of years. But I think the bottom line is, because there is a minimum, these interns are not getting hired at all. That's the experience. And so I'd rather see people getting hired, getting this experience, opening up that door to them, rather than kind of the legislature micromanaging how these startups are getting some help,
Chairman,
and how much they are compensating them. But I would ask for Mr. Alexander's thoughts on that, too.
Chairman. Senator Metzen, to this point?
To this point, I carried this. I thought we cleared it up last year. Senator Tomasoni, you and I really agree on wages that should be paid, but I understand this is just for the interns, the kids that are getting the experience of starting out. It's not...
It's not a family.
It's yeah, and generally speaking, I'm with Tomasoni on this, but on this one, it's the kids and the kids that are just starting and the interns wanting to get going.
Mr. Chairman.
And at $15-$20 an hour, they couldn't get these interns, I understand.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, it doesn't say that, though. It says the business must pay its employees.
I'm just telling you what I know. So
Well, you're not listening.
Well, I am too listening. It's on the record.
I'm happy you're listening, but Mr. Chairman, it says 170. It must pay its employees annual wages, and then it includes interns in the next line. So it includes interns and employees. And boy, I'll tell you, these kids are coming out of college with $80,000 of debt. You think they can afford to pay back their debt on $8 an hour? I don't know what world we're living in here, but.
You're not, Mr. Chairman, you're not going to hire these kids then.
They won't get anything. Seems to mean
Senators, Mr. Alexander, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, to address the internship point in particular, internships are normally held while the student is still a student. It's not a typical job for somebody already out of college. The market does a pretty good job setting those wages. If somebody is working on a degree in engineering or science or is a programmer who would be the typical candidates for the types of internships, you know, I know when I was studying to be a chemical engineer, I worked as an internship on a co-op basis for no pay in order to get the experience, and that experience allowed me to have earn a much better job after I got out of college. And so this modification actually has two components. One is to eliminate the wage restriction for interns in order to encourage participation, and two, to eliminate the wage restrictions on employees so that impediment doesn't prevent those companies from participating in the Angel Investment Tax Credit. And whatever the market is, I mean, if there's not enough people with certain skill sets in the marketplace, the companies have to pay that or they don't get that skill set.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman. If we delete this, as it says in the bill, you won't be hiring interns anyway. You'll just be hiring employees at reduced wages. And if we take out the intern part, then you'll be hiring interns and nobody else. And it's counterproductive to people getting good jobs. I don't care if I lose this motion or not. I'm going to make the motion to reinstate the stricken language on clause number 6, as well as on page 13, as well as reinstate the stricken language on page 12, clause H.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair. Senator Michelle.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'll not encourage or discourage Senator Tomasoni. We can have a minimum wage or living wage conversation on legislation that you want to bring forward anytime. I think for purposes of this bill and this program, which has been around now for a couple years and which has been bipartisan, we're just trying to identify how to keep growing this. This is working. This is working. You heard the deed testimony. So I appreciate the intent, Senator Tomasoni, but I don't want to hurt something that has started and seems to have a pretty good track record.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Michelle, that's my point. It's working.
Senator Tomasoni.
It's working with this language and people are actually making money. And I know you definitely want people to make money and be able to raise themselves up in society and pull themselves up.
They're not hiring interns. That means it's not working. That little piece is not working. We want them to hire more interns.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Michelle, they'll stop hiring. They'll stop paying everybody with this language, and they'll start paying everybody that they hire $8 or $9 an hour. That's what you're doing here,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
It's very seldom that I admit that I made a mistake, and I do listen, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you.
You're not always right either, you know. But I do recall, and it made a lot of sense to me when I put that on last year on the interns. I was the one that knocked that down, because I thought these young people should have a chance to work and get in the system. But I did not agree that we do that to the permanent employees. So I, again, will support Senator Tomasoni's effort to take that stricken language, 134 or 1334, to halfway through 1335. I don't think that should be at the expense of our working men and women. But the interns, I will remain solid on that effort.
Senator Michelle?
Mr. Chair, we have two different proposals now. The first proposal is that we reinstate the language, and the second proposal that Senator Metzen is now proposing is just to reinstate lines 34, 35 on page 13. So I don't know if this is a different motion, if we will vote on this motion and then figure out, but I don't know. These are different ideas.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Metzen, I believe if we do what you just said, that these companies will hire all interns, and they won't hire anybody at a decent wage.
It's nothing.
And they'll pay a minimum wage to these kids, and they won't get any benefits, and they won't have, because an intern is also described as a former student who has graduated in the past 6 months from an accredited institution of higher education. And so I think we should reinstate all the language, because it levels the playing field. And these companies can then decide who they're going to hire, whether they're going to hire interns or not. But there's a definition of intern in the bill, so it says exactly who they are and who they can hire as an intern. So I will maintain my original motion of reinstating the stricken language in clause number 6 on page 13, as well as clause number H on page 12.
All right, Senator Tomasoni has made a motion. Council, could you please restate that motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the motion would be on page 12, reinstate this on lines 12.22 to 12.26, reinstate the stricken language. And on page 13, lines 13.34 to 13.36, reinstate the stricken language. On page 14, lines 14.1 to 14.4, reinstate the stricken language. And on lines 14.4 to 14.5, it doesn't make sense if we keep the new language, so I would delete the new language. And I'd probably create a new clause. So.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make an oral amendment to Senator Tomasoni's amendment.
Proceed.
And I would like council to help me with that, but I'll start with the gist of it, which is on page 13. I would like to amend Senator Tomasoni's amendment to not strike out the first phrase, which is the intern phrase, 13.34 and 13.35. As a mother of a son who graduated in 2010 from one of these higher education institutions, I can tell you these graduates in 2010 would be thrilled to have an intern job at less than minimum wage. It helps pad their resume. It helps get them into the field. So that my amendment would be to, as an oral amendment to Senator Tomasoni's amendment.
What is it?
Okay. Senator Nelson, I'm not sure council understood what that was. Could you please restate
the actual
amendment to the amendment?
The amendment to the amendment would be to unstrike or to insert must pay its employees annual wages of at least 175% of the federal poverty guideline for the year for a family of four. Strike that out of Senator Tomasoni's amendment.
All
Mr. Chairman, are you agreeing with Senator Metzen? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yes.
So I think what she's trying to say is that she wants to leave all the stricken language except for what she read and
exactly.
Take out the lines she just read and leave that, put that back into the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Michelle.
I appreciate the members trying to get their motions right. If there are multiple motions, that's fine. We can deal with them. I just want to be clear that I think the legislation as drafted has built upon a good track record of the last couple of years. Does not need to be amended, is working. The change in the legislation, I think, will help us hire more interns, which would be a great result. And so just to be clear, as we're working on this, I'm going to oppose the Thomasoni motion. And I think if I'm understanding it right, I think I'm even going to oppose the Nelson motion because, again, I think we can stand proudly on the language before us.
Thank you. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle, what's the next stop for this bill?
The Taxes Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, I'd speak. I think we should, I don't think either one of the amendments, that the amended of the amendment, is going to address exactly what you want. And I think I would speak in opposition of both amendments, and then Senator Michelle could work on something if it wants to attach just to interns at the next stop.
Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And somebody may have said this earlier, but what is, do you have an amount for the 100%, 175% of the federal poverty guidelines, just to get people an idea of what we're talking about? How much?
Does that mean, yeah.
Mr. Alexander.
Mr. Chair, it's between $18.50 and $19 an hour.
Imagine how it could be that high.
All right. Senator Dietzick, does that answer your question? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the good discussion, but based upon the discussion we've had, I will withdraw my amendment to the Thomasoni amendment and plan on Senator Michelle working on this further.
Very good. Senator Nelson removes her amendment to the amendment.
Mr.
The Thomasoni amendment.
I'd like a roll call on my amendment, Mr. Chairman.
That was coming. Roll call has been requested. A roll call will be awarded. Senator Dietzick.
Can you reread the amendment to make sure I'm voting?
Council, one more time to the amendment. This is the original Thomasoni amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, the motion is on page 12 to reinstate the stricken language on lines 12.22 to 12.26. On page 13, on lines 13.34 to 13.36, reinstate the stricken language. On page 14, lines 14.1 to 14.4, reinstate the stricken language. And on lines 14.4 to 14.5, delete the new language.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Council, could you please tell us what these changes then effectively does to the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, as Senator Metzen stated earlier, this definition for intern was inserted last year in legislation, and so it would keep the definition of intern, and it makes it so that for interns, they would get paid, if they're hired, they would get paid wages of at least 175% of federal minimum wage, which was stated earlier, $18.50 to $19 an hour. And previously for the Angel Credit Program, all employees of the organizations would also be paid that wage. So it would keep that wage for interns as well as any employees.
All right, members. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Council, can you just clarify? I want to make sure I heard you correctly. So an intern would get paid $18.50 to $19 an hour if we approve the Thomasoni amendment? Or if we do not approve the amendment?
If Mr. Chair, members, if we approve the Thomasoni amendment, it would keep in the Angel Credit Program the requirement that that employees would get paid the 175% of poverty as well as interns, and keep the intern definition included. For interns, it does allow that the requirement can be reduced proportionally if they work less than full time. So there is a little bit difference for interns, but it would keep the intern definition and keep the wage requirement for employees and interns.
Mr. Chair, do that.
Senator Hull.
Mr. Chair, and I think I don't think that is in the spirit of what the intent for interns, and I would just ask members to vote against this amendment and let Senator Michelle work on it as it goes to the next stop. And I'm sure there's going to be modifications when we get to the tax committee, but I don't think that you're going to have any interns hired at $18.50 to $19.50 an hour. You might have a couple in a very specialized field, but you're not going to encourage what we want to encourage with the spirit of this legislation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Keeler.
The minimum wage for interns is 100%, 75% of federal minimum wage, which is $7.15, $7.25 an hour, and that is not $18 an hour. So we're talking about two different wage rates here, one for the poverty guideline, which may be 18, but that's for employees. The minimum wage for the interns would be paid 175% of minimum wage, which is a lot less than that.
$12.50, $12 an hour,
which is pretty minimal even at that. So we're not talking about a huge burden for hiring interns, and then it doesn't even apply if they're only part-time. So,
Senator DeCraif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Students spend an enormous amount of money in order to gain their education. And my experience of students is they're ready to take on the world, which is great, but they have no practical experience. And I look at an internship like it's a continuation of education, and it puts them into a position where they can actually be hired in a practical way. And that costs companies money to train someone. Now, once they have that internship under their belt, now they're in a position that, if they're good, they will be hired away from this company quickly if they really are good. So that, to me, is something for this program. I would hate to dictate that internships have to be paid, because that does cost companies quite a bit of money to train people. So, for that reason, Senator Tomassoni, I would oppose your amendment.
Members, we have a number of guests who have joined us today to listen to one of the future bills. I would like to move towards the vote on this amendment. I'd like to go to Senator Michelle and then move on to the vote. Senator Michelle.
Appreciate the conversation, discussion. Again, we've got something that's working. If we can do something to encourage further college intern hires, that sounds great, especially in this kind of a climate, especially in this kind of economy. And again, I would, the point of this legislation, members, is to help this angel investment tax credit world grow. We've got a good experience so far. It's been bipartisan. And I just wouldn't want to confuse that discussion that we often have, that Senator Tomassoni and I often have, with how much St. Paul, how much government should dictate in the details when hiring private employees.
All right, members, we're going to move on to the roll call.
Senator Michelle.
No.
Senator Daley.
No.
Senator DeCraif.
No.
Senator Dietzick.
Yes.
Senator Howe.
No.
Senator Lilly.
No.
Senator Kielash.
Yes.
Senator Metzen.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
No.
Senator Nelson.
No.
Senator Peterson.
No.
Senator Tomassoni.
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray.
Yes.
Members, the amendment did not pass. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me try another way. Senator Michelle. Beige.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
I just want to we probably have a number of options here as a committee. I just want to note that I have committed to an 11:45 start for the Senator Dames bill, and I know we're close to reaching that point. If there's more conversation that the committee needs to have on this, we could table the bill for now. But I didn't want to start something or sense that Senator Torres Rey was starting something that would impinge upon that commitment. And I know we have some folks in from out of town, and somewhere in between this, we're going to have to run up and check in for a call of the Senate. But we have the room till 12:45, so we still have plenty of time. But I just wanted to be able to start Senator Dames' bill on time.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator. I had a proposal for an amendment to the same amendment that was proposed. So if we don't, so that we don't lose track of it, if I could propose it and vote on it, and then move on to.
All right.
So and actually, I want another. I would like to ask for your support on another amendment. But this amendment is to, if the issue is only interns. And you just voted to delete that. I would like to propose that we leave the part that talks about employees, because it seems that we don't have any argument against that. So I would like to propose that we reinstate the language on page 13 for lines 34 and 35, which says that the business must pay its employees annual wages of at least 175%. So this does not address the language of interns, but it only talks about employees. So it leaves that language in the bill. I'd like to ask for your support on that. So that takes out, Senator, your argument on the intern portion, which it seems that is something that we need to kind of play with in the future, but it leaves actual employees.
Senator Michelle.
I would oppose that amendment, members, per some of my earlier comments about, again, just the legislature dictating details on a program that's working.
All right. So let's proceed to a vote on that amendment. All those in favor signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Division.
Division.
Okay.
Just raise your hand.
All right.
All those in favor, raise your hand. The amendment. All right. And those opposed? The motion does not prevail. All right. Moving on to the bill. Senator Michelle.
Mr. Chair and members, I would move that Senate File 1774 be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee.
Senator Torres Rey.
Senator, I'm sorry. I'm going to do this very quickly and ask for your support on this amendment. That was really the amendment, but then this discussion came up and it was an opportunity to step in. I have an amendment on page 11. We have been questioning whether or not these new programs are actually making a difference for recruitment of minorities and women in this new approaches and the number of jobs that we're creating in those communities. So I would like to ask Senator Michelle if he could support an amendment to line 25, subdivision 11, number 8, to read the gross number of jobs, comma, including information on gender and ethnicity, comma, created by investments. So I would like to include the sentence, including information on gender and ethnicity, into that line.
I'd be fine with that.
Senator Michelle.
Senator Torres Rey, I'd support that. I don't know if the Senate Council caught the language, but.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, members, the motion would be on page 11, line 11.25, after jobs, insert, comma, including information on gender and ethnicity.
Senator Miller. Senator Howell?
Mr. Chair, Senate Counsel, can you direct me to exactly where that location is again?
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, members, on page 11, line 11.25.
So on 11.25, it would read, the gross number of jobs, comma, including information on gender and ethnicity created by investments made by each Minnesota business investment company and the number of jobs retained.
Senator Howell.
Mr. Chair, I'd request a roll call on this.
Okay. All right. Roll call has been requested. Roll call is granted.
All right.
Any further discussion? All right. Roll call.
Senator Michelle.
Yes.
Senator Daley.
Yes.
Senator DeKreif.
Yes.
Senator Dietzick.
Yes.
Senator Howe.
Yes.
Senator Lilly.
Yes.
Senator Kielash.
Yes.
Senator Metzen.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
Yes.
Senator Nelson.
Yes.
Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni.
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray.
Yes.
Victory, victory.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator.
The motion does pass.
Mr. Chair, I'd renew my motion then on Senate File 1774.
Yeah. As amended?
Yes.
Yes. All right, members, any further discussion? All those in favor signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Thank you, members.
I'm not able to get a half a loaf of bread for the working minute women, but
the new moving at the speed of light.
Yeah, this snail. Turtle.
All right, Senator Dames with Senate File 827. Senator Dames, we've been doing some gymnastics here, trying to make sure we're on time for you. And members, just a note, and for those in the audience, so at some point in the next 15, 20 minutes, we'll have a call of the Senate, I'm assuming. And I'm also assured that we only have kind of some paperwork today. So I would expect we'd be able to run up to the floor, punch in, and then come back down here. We've got the room until close to 1 when the Ag Committee, I believe, takes it over. So we've got time. I've got a number of folks scheduled to testify both in support and in opposition. So let's kick it off here. Senator Dames, welcome to the Jobs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, I am Senator Dames, and I'm here today to introduce Senate File number 827. Mr. Chairman, we do have an amendment, the A1 amendment.
We'll pass that out. Hang on a sec, Senator Dames, so people have that, the members have that. So members, we're passing out the A1. I think we've all got the A1 now. Senator Dames, do you want to describe the A1?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A1 amendment on page 1, line 11, we delete the language on the original bill and add heavy construction projects as defined by Minnesota rules and insert projects and projects on underground facilities as defined in section 216D-01, subdivision 11. Page 1, line 12, we delete part 5200-101010, and then on page 1, line 13, we, after the period, insert, as used in this paragraph, week, applies to work performed Monday through Saturday. That would be the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dames. So in the form of an author's amendment, then Senator Daley offers the A1. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. A1 is adopted. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 827 is a bill for an act relating to employment, modifying certain prevailing hours of labor requirements, amending statutes 2010, section 177.42, subdivision 4. And with that said, I have four testifiers with me today. I have Mr. Tom Werke, Deanne Stish, Julie Mathewitz Anderson, and Mark Saline. So I will turn it over to Tom to start with to explain the bill further.
Very good. So, Mr. Werke, welcome to the Jobs Committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Senator Michelle, committee members. My name is Tim Werke. I represent the Associated General Contractors. We're the state's oldest, largest construction trade association. We have over 450 members, mostly union contractors. And I'm here today to testify in favor of Senator Dames' bill. Let me, for the record, just clarify for the committee that what we're trying to do here. The purpose of this bill is to amend the state prevailing wage law to allow four 10-hour days scheduled at straight time on publicly funded state highway and underground construction projects Monday through Saturday only. Our proposal only affects state highway and underground construction covered by the Minnesota prevailing wage law. Mr. Chairman, the reason we are supportive of this legislation is because we believe it affects or it reflects the current industry practice in the private sector, and we think it provides a level of efficiency and scheduling efficiency for our contractor members. The four 10-hour workday schedule, as I said, has been increasingly more common in public and private construction scheduling. On the public side, a number of states have four 10-hour day statutes pertaining to construction. An example in the private sector is the National Industrial Maintenance Agreement for construction work. And, Mr. Chair, I have a handout for the committee that I'd like the page or someone to hand out. The reason I'm passing this out is it's a letter from the president of what is referred to as the Association of Union Contractors, and it's these are the folks that put together the National Maintenance Agreement, which is the governing document on heavy industrial projects around the country. And in Minnesota last year, over 100 projects were performed under the National Maintenance Agreement. And as you'll see in this letter, the president of that organization is supportive of our effort to move to a four 10-hour day paid at straight time on public work in Minnesota. Another reason we're supportive of this legislation is that some of the trades already allow in their collective bargaining agreements a four 10-hour day payable at straight time. Some of the examples of these agreements are the Operating Engineers Highway Agreement, which indicates that overtime is to be paid after 40 hours in a week, and also the Teamsters Agreement, which indicates that overtime is to be paid after 40 hours in a week or after 12 hours per day. Some agreements, like the Carpenters and Iron Workers, have provisions that specifically outline how contractors may implement a schedule of four 10-hour days. And, Mr. Chairman, I have another handout to illustrate that the trades have agreed to some of these changes in the collective bargaining process. This is a copy, and I'll wait till the page can hand this out. This is a copy of the Carpenters Agreement that we are currently operating under. And there's a statement in that agreement that says, the parties agree to work cooperatively to amend state law to allow four 10-hours at straight time. It's an illustration that some of the trades are supportive of this and are willing to work with us as owners, as employers, to make this change in state law. What are the benefits to the employee? A four 10-hour schedule allows a three-day weekend for employees and their families. It cuts drive time and driving distance to and from the work site. thereby reducing fuel consumption, travel time, and travel subsistence payments, meaning the overnight accommodations that employees have to pay when they're working on these remote job sites. 410s is considered part of a green environmental strategy by many construction owners and designers. You may have heard of LEED construction certification. A 410-hour day gives you credit as towards LEED environmental construction as part of that work product. 410s also provides fewer days for the contractors to mobilize the construction site, thereby saving fuel and related construction expenditures. So why do we seek this legislation? As I noted previously, the AGC, as a trade association of employers, we negotiate most of the collective bargaining agreements with the major construction trades. A change in state law is necessary to set the overtime standard for publicly funded work. Once the change is made, we would go back into our contracts with the trades and ask for an amendment to reflect the changed state law. So you might ask, why do we not just collectively bargain this issue? You may hear today from some of the opponents that this change is something that they would like to be settled at the bargaining table. First, this issue is not new to the trades. We have been working on this issue as an organization for a long time, and as I said, 410s are provisions that already existed in bargain contracts for private work. The fact is the employers are stuck in a catch-22 position here. We cannot implement a 410 work schedule on state-funded projects until the law is changed, and the trades insist that this needs to be bargained in contract negotiations before they could support a law change. I would simply ask the committee to consider the following regarding this situation. When the current law was established, allowing or changing to overtime after 8 hours in 1973, that provision was not subject to collective bargaining. So why is it an issue now impacting our discussion today? To summarize, in a difficult economic time, we are searching for ways to be more efficient. We believe a 410-hour day for Minnesota contractors can be another scheduling option that has been tested in other states and become the standard practice in many sectors of the construction industry. We believe Senate 827 represents a small incremental change to state prevailing wage statutes that brings benefits to both employees and to employers, and we urge the committee's adoption of the legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. I have Ms. Stish.
Stish. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. and Chairman, members of the committee. Chairman, my name is Deanne Stish.
Oh. Real quickly. Mr. Chairman, we had an amendment that changed the bill a little bit, and I don't think anybody explained what it actually does as opposed to what it was before.
Senator Dames did walk through it, and we did adopt it as an author's amendment.
He read some stuff, but I don't think he explained the amendment.
I'm told we're under call, but I'd like to take a little more of the testimony.
Maybe I didn't understand what he said. I don't know. But
he did the mumble like you, Senator Tomasoni. So.
He wasn't listening, Senator.
Ms. Stish,
the mumble when you don't want people to hear.
Depending on how long you – I don't know if you have a couple minutes, but I don't want to interrupt. So we could either – we're under call now, which means we're going to leave the room and come back. But if your testimony is kind of in the – less than 5 minute category, I'd like to let you.
I'm from the Iron Range. I can mumble very quickly all the way through and just raise a hand and I'll stop.
All right, Ms. Stish. Take a run at it.
My name is Deanne Stish and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Utility Contractors Association. And our organization represents those construction companies who do underground work, the sewer and water type of projects that are funded both through state and federal funding. I've spent 20 years in public policy on behalf of working men and women across the state, and if I thought for a moment that the 410 provision you have before you today was a step backwards for working the working community, I certainly wouldn't be here. The measure before you is very simple. It's a very narrow change that puts Minnesota in step with what our neighbors in the Midwest have already realized and 30-some states across the country that containing the work week to 410s provides a real benefit for both projects themselves as well as the working community. We used to bid on projects that were just a stone's throw from home. Now more and more we're traveling 50, 100 miles to get to projects. Workers are staying in hotels for longer periods of times away from their family at their own cost. If we're able to productively condense the workday into 10 hours, it's a benefit for everyone. The bill does resolve this growing lack of flexibility. If it rains on a Tuesday, it's not a matter of whether or not you're going to gain overtime. It's whether or not you're even going to reach 40 hours in a work week. You'll be left with 32 hours. As a project's costs have been contained to a certain amount, profit margins have shrunk to down to one, if not below cost, and any additional overtime just isn't in the project bid itself. And that's an important component to remember when you are working. And it does rain. In the event you have the option for 410s, you could pick up hours as the week goes on. And from a cost factor, as Tim pointed out, you're having people less time on the road, having the opportunity to have a longer weekend, congestion, and a host of other issues like that that allow people to then pick up hours. And I think this is the most important thing that we could do, is to provide flexibility, provide opportunities for more hours in a week. We have had this bill before multiple committees in the past. We've got the Department of Labor's legislative auditor's analysis on this bill that provides good feedback on what its financial costs to the state, the benefits that there are. I'll have the page hand these out so you could take a quick read on the legislative auditor's report on this. It's a great standard, as I talked about. Those other states in the Midwest have already realized that Mother Nature's the true boss when it comes to construction. Once Mother Nature releases its grip here in the spring, we're able to get out. I'm sure many of you watch the program Gold Rush. You know that Mother Nature is ultimately the one that can control when we can dig in the ground. If we have a rain event, we also have to allow for environmental remediation. Our industry in particular has a great role to play in erosion control management. That adds time to that project. It's not on a daily, hourly basis that we look at projects. The more we can condense them into a shorter period of time, the more benefit and the longer the season will be, so that you get to more projects, and that's where the potential is for longer season for both the working community as well as the owners of the projects. So there's a real balance in both the environment, energy efficiency, and keeping congestion off the road. Getting through these projects, communities struggle with such a small window for dirt-disturbing construction every year. Communities rely on us to upgrade sewer and water projects, and we have no shortfall of those throughout the state of Minnesota. So I think we have benefits all around. I know this week has had some contentious issues facing it. We don't want to confuse a lot of those broader issues here with what we're looking at in this bill. This is a very narrowed provision that merits have been vetted extensively, and we hope we can answer any questions that have come up. The amendment that we presented was an attempt to try to continue to narrow down the types of work that are covered under this. And you'll see the utility component of that narrowed further from just the highway and heavy, so we pulled that out of the statute to present the clean and drinking water workers rather than pull in the facilities would have been captured on the original definition of highway and heavy in the bill. So that's one of the benefits of the amendment. We're trying to narrow down who this affects and those that have the most impact from the weather. So with that, we'll restate our support as an association, and we hope that we can answer any questions and confusion regarding this bill at any point, and look forward to moving this forward. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Stish. What I'd like to do is ask Julie Anderson and Mark Sellen or Celine to join Senator Dames at the table there, and we will continue with the testimony. And members, I will... If we learn of a roll call, of course we'll recess at that point. But we're not expecting any, so I'd like to be able to continue this without interruption. So, Ms. Anderson,
actually, could Mark go first if that's
okay,
all right?
Okay, that's fine. Thanks. Mr. I'm going to get it wrong. How do you say?
Celine.
Celine.
It's Celine. Swedish.
Welcome to the Jobs Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Celine, president of Celine Brothers Incorporated. We're a highway and underground construction company in western Minnesota, located between Moorhead and Detroit Lakes on Highway 10. We are a union contractor signatory to the Local 49. We are in favor for Senate File 827. The reason we are is that it will give us the flexibility to schedule our projects to benefit our employees and the communities that we work in. I'd like to cite an example. For example, if we bid a project for a 48-hour work week, we're looking at 4 10s Monday through Thursday and 8 hours on Friday to give a 48-hour work week, which will give the employee 40 hours of straight time and 8 hours of overtime. Okay, say we lose a day to rain or a holiday during the course of the week. Under the current prevailing wage law, if we want to keep our project on budget and the schedule on time, then we're going to shift our work week back one day. So say, for example, we lose Tuesday, we'd have to work 10 hours on Monday, we get rained out on Tuesday, we resume our project on Wednesday. To get our 40 hours in, we go 10, 10, 10, and then on Saturday we get 8. So we get 40 hours of straight time, 8 hours of overtime to meet our budget and the schedule that we discussed. Under SF 827, we'll be able to condense our work week into 4 days. What will happen is we'll free up the Saturday. For example, if we work 10 hours on Monday, we get rained out on Tuesday, and then we're able to work, say, 13, 13, 12 to get our 48 hours in, 40 hours of straight time, 8 hours of overtime in a 4-day work week, freeing up Saturday for our employees to be with their families and the communities that we work in so they're not disrupted in the summer. So in closing, we're in favor of Senate File 827, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Saline. Ms. Anderson.
Thank you. I'm Julie Anderson, and I'm with Mathewitz Construction, and we are also in rural Minnesota. We are located out near Mankato, to the west slightly. And we are a heavy highway contractor. We do an awful lot of grading work for the Department of Transportation, and we do work as well with the counties and the cities out in the rural area. The reality is that the radius of work that we as contractors have had to go to get work has grown. And in the last 5 years, our employees have had much more times where they actually have to stay away from home for a job. The benefits that Mathewitz Construction sees from this for our employees is we do have most of our senior employees actually request weekends off. They want their Saturdays back. And unfortunately, as Mr. Saline has mentioned, on rain weeks, when we miss a Tuesday, the whole crew basically gets the word that Saturday is now a work day because that is our 8 hours of straight time that we have to get. And it's going to happen on a rain week no matter what. If we could have this bill, then the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday days could be 10-hour days of straight time as well. What our employees would see as a benefit is typically they book their hotels Monday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, and they don't book a Friday. As soon as they find out on Thursday or Friday that they have to stay the weekend, now they have to book that additional weekend night. Guess what? It's never at the same week rates that they were able to fill in for the previous nights. They always end up paying a weekend rate. And so we feel that our employees will benefit greatly from this on that side. Now, granted, the employers will also see benefits because we will be able to get more hours in those days. So it really is a benefit to both sides on this bill. We calculated out the funding on that side, and the hotel nights on the weekend rates is almost the exact same number that an employee would lose in the overtime rates that they will maybe lose earlier in the week on a short week. But we, in our heavy highway, we don't usually get to work short weeks very often. So, you know, Monday through Friday are definitely work days. And when the rain hits, we end up putting in Saturday. So we really support this bill. We see it as a win-win situation. It avoids commutes. You know, we don't work in the metro area, but, you know, we know that there are contractors that do commute every day now. And if you can put in a 4-10-hour day, they can actually get their start and stop time outside of the commute times, which up in the metro area up here everyone lives with daily. And you can get your employees' work time around that so that you're not quite as tight in on getting stuck in traffic and spending time there. You know, we, as Mathewitz Construction, we believe in family time, and when we can give our employees those Saturdays, when we can give our employees their evenings for their families on Fridays, that is a huge benefit for our employees. So Mathewitz Construction is very supportive of this bill. Thank you.
All right. So thank you. Senator Dames, I apologize for the interruption here, as promised, but I think this is a good time. So let's take a first of all, a quorum is present. So I'm going to recess the committee until 12:25, and we'll have at least a half an hour then for the other side of this testimony. I appreciate Mr. Melander's help in choreographing all that. So, members, committee's in recess.
So you guys are going to hang on. A little aerobics. Yeah, because we'll probably get into some questions.
If you want, this explain the amendment.
Yeah, I can't do that.
This is the underground definition. Sure, that's what he's going to be curious about.
What I'll probably do is have you come back, go through it. Big questions on it.
Have the questions.
Go through it.
So you can keep this. I have it.
Yeah. You guys are going to hang around.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, good. Well done.
Oh, shit.
I'll let you know. 2%.
We held pretty close to our time commitment, Senator Dames.
That's enough. I appreciate that. Yep. And do you have some other folks that are going to testify? We might as well get them up here so we get going.
Let me ask Mr. Melander to join us at the table. And I know we've had some revisions to the list of folks who want to testify, but
can you grab Jason and tell him the.
I don't know if they're going to have anything, but it would be nice.
If there are members in here.
Mr. Melander, if you're ready to kick things off, the tape is running. Welcome to the Jobs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to address the committee regarding Senate File 827, and also thank you to those construction professionals that have been in the room for 3 hours. Chair Michelle, my name is Harry Melander. I am the chair of the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Council. Our council represents over 50,000 construction workers throughout the great state of Minnesota, and today we are here to testify in opposition to Senate File 827. Senate File 827 will give a pay cut to all Minnesotans that currently work on projects where Minnesota state prevailing wage law exists. It will take the standard 8-hour day and extend it to 10 hours, reducing individuals' compensation by nearly 10%. This major modification will create wage reductions for construction workers that have seen unemployment rates similar to those that existed during our last Great Depression. It will also have a social impact on the industry and the participants and their family. Today you will hear statements from contractors, working Minnesota, industry leaders, and public officials that are also in opposition to Senate File 827 that gives Minnesota construction workers a pay cut. Chair, committee members, today you've heard from supporters of the bill. I would like to comment that I believe on what I believe is the fictional portion of their facts presented and what we believe this bill will do to the backbone of the industry, the hardworking Minnesotans that have built the state's infrastructure, what we believe these modifications will do to the Minnesota construction worker. As stated earlier by testifiers, the 10-hour workday, regarding the 10-hour workday, that it is the norm for working in the highway and heavy portion of the industry is somewhat of a half-truth. Although 10 hours and sometimes longer period of times may be used in these industries, it is not the basis of what we describe as a workday. The workday always has been based off of a 40-hour work week. There's nothing preventing individuals from working for contractors, working longer than the hours stated above. But the law states that those individuals will be compensated at time and a half after 8 and after 40 hours during a given work week. Any modification to the 8-hour workday will give Minnesota construction workers a pay cut. We also heard today that contractors and employees mutually benefit from an 8-hour workday, providing longer periods of personal time with families and friends. I can assure you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that the nature of this industry may be one that has concerns for the individuals that work in it, but it's not the primary goal. Although we have a strong industry partnership with our contractors and their professional associations, contractors are entrepreneurs, capitalists that create successful business models for themselves or their shareholders. Mr. Chairman, we are very supportive of the capitalist appetite that exists within our industry. We believe that if our contractors are profitable, then we too will benefit from that. The highway heavy industry is performed primarily with heavy equipment that costs thousands and sometimes millions of dollars. Idle machinery does not make money. No contractor will place his or her machinery in idle to provide their workers with longer weekends. One can only imagine the outrage of Minnesota taxpayers when they watch equipment sit idle on Thursday through Sunday because contractors want to provide more quality time for their employees. This will not happen. this does not happen, and any representation that it will is not being truthful regarding how this industry has and will continue to operate. In a moment, we will attempt to bring clarity in regards to the whole green or energy-saving myth that may have been presented today. Our organization supports energy-saving methodology, but we will once again describe the facts rather than the fictional representation that has been presented thus far. Another section of the bill that attempts to redefine the highway portion within the statute. We believe that it is not clear and also needs a revision to accurately describe what we believe the author of the bill is attempting to do. The highway heavy definition is very broad, from road construction, dam building, power generating, and other industrial types work. We support reviewing the highway and heavy portion of the statute. We've been working with committee leadership for over the past year to attempt to make this needed incremental change and believe that we were heading in that direction. For a community or party that believes in less government regulation, this modification will set a standard that does not accurately describe what is happening in the industry regarding compensation. Although a number of our affiliates do have flexibility regarding work days and work week, it is not broad-reaching and inclusive of all the industry participants. We believe that our building community, that our building contractors, set the standard for the norm what happens in Minnesota's construction economy. Any other comments regarding who drives this industry, we would be more than happy to debate at another time. We have set the standards regarding training, job site culture, safety, and compensation before the statute was placed in the law. Comments that other organizations steer this industry are false and somewhat exaggerated delusions. Mr. Chairman, committee members, we have a strong partnership throughout Minnesota with a large majority of those that we call the Minnesota construction industry. We, too, believe that law should accurately reflect what happens within the industry. We believe that the modifications presented in Senate File 827 attempt to do that, but miss the mark and create a wage structure that, again, cuts Minnesota workers, will not provide families with that additional time for activities, including faith-based participation, both on Saturday and Sunday, that are necessary to build a strong community. That the representation of fuel savings could be argued, but the reality of this industry, caused by our climate, requires long work weeks rather than what was described earlier. Mr. Chairman, please encourage the industry partners, the private side of our economy, to continue to discuss ways that we can effectively manage our industry and continue on working on the work that our committee started with your leadership last year. Thank you for your time. I'd be more than happy to answer questions now or at the conclusion of our team's presentation. If there are no questions, Jason George with the operating engineers will address the committee.
Let's try to get through the, I think we have at least six testifiers, so thank you, Mr. Melander. Mr. George, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jason George. I'm the legislative and political director of the operating engineers, Local 49. Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask for your indulgence before I begin my testimony. There's a contractor that wanted to be here today that was actually rearranged his schedule to be here last Tuesday when the hearing was canceled, and I have a letter from him. Would it be okay if I read it into the record for 30 seconds?
Sure.
Okay.
Please.
This is from Mr. Mark Draper from Mankato Electric, who, again, couldn't be here today. Mr. Chair, this letter is in opposition to the bill being put forth that would change the prevailing wage hours of labor from 8 hours a day to 4 10-hour hours in a week. I am the president of Mankato Electric, Inc., and the vast majority of my company's work is done under prevailing wage laws. The work that my company does is primarily outdoor construction, and because of Minnesota's winters, mostly seasonal. Because of this, the people that are employed for me work long hours during the summer and are away from their families for large amounts of time. They are well paid for what they do, and they deserve it. The prevailing wage hours are changed to 4 10-hour hours in a week. My employees will not start working Monday through Thursday. This is simply not possible with Minnesota's short construction season and the tight time frames that MnDOT is currently putting on jobs. Being a seasonal contractor, both my employees and myself need to work every day that we can and will continue to do so. However, what will happen if this bill is passed is that the incomes of the workers working on prevailing wage jobs will be decreased. While we try to work every day we can, the fact of the matter is that weather sometimes won't allow that. On the average, one day every 2 weeks is lost to rain. In the spring, it is closer to 1 week, once a week. Under the proposed bill, if an employee worked 3 10-hour days and the rest of the week was lost to rain, overtime would not be paid. This is simply not fair to the employees. Men and women in my industry work long, hard days in the cold and heat of Minnesota. Their hours are not guaranteed like an employee working in an office building or a factory. My employees oftentimes work far in excess of 40 hours a week. Factors outside of my control sometimes dictate that they work far less than 40 hours. Because of this, I believe the current law is fair and compensates my employees for the hard work that they do and the time away from their families. Thank you. Sincerely, Mark Draper, president of Mankato Electric, and I have a copy if you want to see it. I'll move into my testimony now, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for letting me do that. Contrary to what you might have heard from proponents of this and other bills, prevailing wage is working well in Minnesota. The current law is doing exactly what it was intended to do, which is to ensure that Minnesota taxpayers, construction workers, and contractors are protected from cheap, out-of-state business owners looking to come in here and take our public works projects. In Minnesota, only 8% of our highway projects go to out-of-state contractors. When looking at 8% a little closer, you quickly realize that most of that work is being taken by Knife River Corporation, which is based in North Dakota. While they are an out-of-state contractor, most of their employees are Minnesota residents, so that number goes even down. So I think it's fair to say that under the current system, almost all people working on highway projects in Minnesota actually live in Minnesota, which is a good thing, and which is what prevailing wage is intended to do. In 2010, according to MnDOT numbers, infrastructure projects came in $67 million under engineer estimates. That is 9% savings to taxpayers from what MnDOT originally budgeted for the projects. This was done under the current prevailing wage system, paying workers the current prevailing wage rates, and paying workers overtime after 8 hours. I've heard a lot of people lately saying we need to tweak prevailing wage. And that leads me to ask this question. If the taxpayers are saving money and getting highly skilled local workers and local contractors on our jobs, what's the issue? Senate File 827 is a bill in search of a problem in many other ways as well. Mr. Chairman, there is no law or regulation or rule that I'm aware of that states that a contractor cannot set a work schedule of 4 10-hour days right now, this minute. This bill doesn't allow them to do anything that they already are not allowed to do under current law. The real issue here is not work schedules or time for workers to spend with their families or improving the environment or the need to tweak. The real issue, in our opinion, is dollars and cents. Let me give you a scenario that is not uncommon. One of the people you see in the audience shows up for work, works 10 hours on Monday and Tuesday. It rains on Wednesday and Thursday. They come back to work 10 hours Friday and Saturday. Under current law, they get 2 hours of overtime each day they work. Under this change, they get nothing, no overtime at all. Doing the math, this means that they take home around $100 less in rain-shortened weeks like this. Our members only get to work an average of 1,450 hours per year due to the seasonal nature of this job. Do the math on that, it averages out to $43,000 a year. I don't think anybody in this room is getting rich moving dirt. In the last 3 years of the recession, the people in this room have been hit the hardest as well. In a minute, I will introduce an operating engineer that will tell you how this bill will impact him personally. Before I do, let me comment briefly on how our union works, because I've heard a lot this session about our need to tweak or to cooperate on prevailing wage. Our union and other billing trades unions work hand-in-hand with our contractors on a daily basis. We are usually here together, advocating for construction projects that will make them money and will put our guys to work, our people to work. Our relationship goes beyond advocating for jobs. Together, we have built and managed a state-of-the-art training facility and apprenticeship program, one of the best in the country. We have built one of the best healthcare systems in the country together. We manage it together, and together we have implemented programs that save money and create better care for our members. Together, we have built a pre-apprentice training program for women and minorities to both give them more people an opportunity and to have available workforce for our contractors on state-funded jobs that have goals. We have also worked for the past year, as Mr. Melander stated, to try to figure out how we can change prevailing wage in a way that benefits both workers and contractors. We went so far as to propose some changes in ongoing discussions with Senator Peterson. Instead of taking that approach, a collaborative approach, we find ourselves here today testifying against a bill that will cut wages for all highway construction workers in the state of Minnesota, union and non-union. This is truly disappointing. I want to now introduce you to Scott Stocky, Local 49 member, operating engineer, who's going to tell you how this bill will negatively impact his pocketbook and his family. Thanks a lot.
So, Mr. Melander, I just want to double check on the names here. So I don't have this gentleman's name, which is fine, but is this part of Mr. George's testimony then, or how should I have Mr. Dedrick next?
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, apologize for the correction, but that gentleman was Dietrich was unable to come today.
Okay, so I should take off Mr. Dietrich. And, sir, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
My name is Scott Stonkey. I'm an operating engineer. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thanks for hearing me today. I live in central Minnesota and a heavy equipment operator. I've worked on highway infrastructure projects during my career as an operator, which began in 1980. I'm a second-generation 49er. There are a group of equipment operators here today, and I volunteered to come up here and let you know how we feel about File 827. We have a lot of concerns about this proposal, and we would respectfully ask you to vote against it. Mr. Chairman, this bill will not do what proponents have said it will do. I have built roads and bridges all over the state, and there is one thing I know for sure. The sun is shining. We are working. Saturdays, whatever day, whatever it has to be. I just don't believe for a second that on a sunny Friday morning, an employer is going to send me home after working four tens to be with my family. It's not my experience in the industry or anyone else's that I have talked to. We are going to work Friday and possibly Saturday, whether or not prevailing wage law says four tens and five eighths. The real point of this bill is to adjust the wages. If there's weather during the week and we end up not being able to work past 40 hours, I'm going to lose overtime pay. I currently get for working longer days or weekends, make up for lost rain days. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, every construction worker, union or non-union, that works in the heavy industry relies on the overtime pay during short weeks to make it through the bleak winter months. Every dollar I get in overtime during the summer helps me put food on the table in December. There is no question that if you vote this bill, you are going to cut construction workers' pay, and you will make it harder for us to get by. I work hard, so do all construction workers that have come here today. The last few years have been difficult for all of us. There isn't enough work, and families have suffered. I am here today to ask you not to make things worse. Please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
So, Mr. Melander, I have Dan McConnell
yes.
on the list, and then also Tom Huting.
Mr. Chair, there will be Mr. Parker and okay. Mr. Hinding, and that's it.
All right, so if this is Mr. McConnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Dan McConnell. I'm the business manager of the Minneapolis Building and Construction Trade Council. President Melander asked me to give you a little bit more background on this the national maintenance agreements that Mr. Werke referenced. I got a list of from the National Maintenance Agreement Policy Committee of all the sites in the Minnesota where we have national maintenance agreements. It's a total of 41 sites. Sites mostly paper mills, the Duluth Salt Dock, power plants, and the Ford plant, and some mines. Not really an apples-to-apples comparison. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's an apples-to-oranges comparison to think that for someone like myself who's worked on highway construction and in these different plants, you're working outside, you're in the weather, there's no shade on a highway. They don't plant trees in the middle of the road for some reason. I don't know why. But to say that you're going to compare that experience of working inside a plant where you're excluded from the weather, you're in a different environment, and to say that that correlates to what goes on in a highway construction project is completely false in my view. Excuse me. Like I said, I've worked on construction projects, and like other people have mentioned here, this idea that it's green, that we'll save time commuting, is completely false. We're going to spend every day that there's sun, the sun is shining. While the sun's shining, you have to make hay, right? For a farmer analogy, but you're not going to have equipment sitting idle, equipment that costs tens of thousands of dollars. It doesn't make you 1 cent to have it sit for 3 days a week. And like President Melander mentioned, you know, when people are commuting to their cabins on the weekend and they're going to drive by and they're going to see, they're already frustrated by the amount of road construction we see in the summer. To the idea that we're going to see that equipment sit for 3 days, 40% of the time, when you have such a short season, it's already sitting during the winter, it's just not reality. We appreciate your time and your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. McConnell. This is Mr. Parker.
Mr. Chair, these are brief comments.
Okay, great. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Heiding. Retired electrician, I live in Rochester, Minnesota. I was a 38 member of the local 343. As has been stated in this bill, will result in cuts in take-home pay for people, union and non-union, people working on prevailing wage projects. Many of those people, those families, have been without adequate income for several years, losing their health insurance, homes, and more. I have three electrician friends who have been laid off over 2 years, have run out of unemployment, have exhausted their bank hours of health benefits. Cutting their take-home pay by even 1 hour of every time pay hurts. That's only 1 half hour worth of extra money. That may not seem like a lot of money to you, but it's the world when you've been out of work as long as my friends and neighbors have been. It will take them a long time to pay off their debts and just get even. They may never get back to where they were before this terrible recession. Please don't make it even harder for them to survive. It will not create jobs. It will only put more money in the boss's pocket and less in working Minnesotans who are desperately needed every dollar that they can earn. Thanks for listening to my testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Let's take that. I think there's at least one other name, Senator Thomasoni, and then I know there's a couple members who want to have a discussion. Yes, sir. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Jobs Committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Scott Parker. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, once again, my name is Scott Parker, and I'm a painter with the International Union of Painters Allied Trades District Council 82 in Local 681 in Rochester. And I'm a proud member to call Mazeppa, Minnesota, my home, where I've been a city councilman for the last 16 years. In the early 1930s, prevailing wage was sponsored by two Republicans, Senator James J. Davis from Pennsylvania and Congressman Robert Bacon from New York. Davis-Bacon was and remains about providing a livable wage for people in the communities in which we live. In 1973, Governor Wendell Anderson signed into law here in Minnesota. Again, it was and still remains about providing a living wage for people to be able to live in the communities in which they work, thus enabling them to provide economic strength for the communities by not only working there, but reinvesting through consumer spending, home ownership, and providing the cities with additional revenue from property taxes, etc. By changing this law, a real possibility exists that people will no longer be able to live in the communities in which they work. The local growth will come to a stop, and businesses will close their doors. They will not fill the city coffers. Changing this law will also allow a substandard workforce to peck away at our infrastructure. We all know that the contract goes to the lowest bidder, who in turn will pocket the bulk of those monies and pay their unskilled labor a subsistence wage and put the community at risk through shoddy workmanship. Whereas having a prevailing wage law provides a safety net of sorts in that every bidder has to provide a living wage to their workers, the contractors are more likely to have a skilled labor workforce as well as provide safe working conditions for their people. Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you.
Thank you. I have Mr. Melander, maybe you had some concluding comments or any more testifiers?
No, that's us, Mr. Chairman. If the committee has any questions, I'll attempt to answer them.
Please stay close by. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, it seems like through the testimony that even if there was a change to go to 4 10-hour work weeks, 4 10-hour days, that you're going to go into overtime anyhow. So has anybody ran the numbers, on this to see if you're going to end up working a Friday and end up working a Saturday anyhow, what difference this change is going to make? Because, I think the last testifier talked about actually changing the prevailing wage, which this bill doesn't do. But it seems like for everybody who testified says it doesn't matter. They're going to get overtime anyhow. So I'm wondering, what are the numbers on that?
Senator, Miller. I'll try to, not being a mathematician or probably struggling a bit with it, but it's pretty straightforward. I'll just use the example of going from a 10-hour workday or an 8-hour workday to a 10-hour workday. Individuals, as I mentioned in my comments, are going to get a 10% wage reduction. So instead of getting paid 40 hours a week, they'll be compensated, or 41 hours a week, they'll be compensated at 40. As that time gets longer, that number actually will increase. We've done a number of scenarios and would be more than happy to provide those to you to say that no matter how we look at it, that workers in Minnesota with this provision will take a pay cut from what exists today.
Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you already said this and I missed it, but how does it work on road construction when there is weather? When people show up at the job site, do they get compensated for coming to the job site X amount or not at all? Or how do they account for how does the contractor adjust for weather-related events on road construction?
Senator, I will tell you that the difference between that our industries than others is that there may be from time to time a provision within a bargaining agreement. That's just talking within my community. But the reality is that when we're working, we get paid. When we're not working, we do not. We do not get vacation time. We pay for our own health benefits, our own training. When we work, we get paid for the work we're doing. When there's no work, we go home.
One more follow-up, Senator. So are you saying because that when you're on a job site, you're not getting paid regardless of the equipment? Is it only the time the equipment is running? Help me go through that because I've had buildings built and things,
sure.
and usually when the equipment shows up on the job site, the time clock starts. It's not when the equipment gets, it's not just the time it's running. It's every hour it's on the job site. I'm getting billed for that piece
of equipment. And Chair, Senator, if I may ask you a question just for a clarification so I can respond to your question correctly. I'm assuming this hypothetical example that we're given is that I come to work at 8 o'clock, or let's say the reality is I come to work at 6 o'clock in the morning when the sun's up, and I work 4 hours, and all of a sudden the monsoon comes. I will still be compensated. The contractor, he or she, will make a determination if, in fact, they're going to take a chance and see if the weather will change so we can get back to the work that we came to at 6 o'clock in the morning, or if, in fact, they select or chose to have those individuals go home, they won't be compensated. They'll be compensated from the time that they're on the site.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. There's been a number of tragedies in the construction business the last few years and quite frankly, fatalities. And Mr. Dames, have you looked at any studies that pertain to the safety of our people that are working these longer hours, from 8 to 10 hours? I'm thinking about the fatigue and maybe more tragedies out there. Have you looked at that,
Senator Dames or Mr. Werke, perhaps?
Mr. Chair and Senator Metz and I have not looked at that, but just listening to the testimony today, we've heard about working overtime. So they're working overtime already. So if what we're currently doing is stressing the situation, then maybe we need to be looking at something totally different. I don't see that this is going to add that stress when we're already working overtime has been talked about with so many testifiers. But I have not done the study, Senator Metz.
Senator Dames, oh, this is not a 10-hour deal. This is 4 10-hours in a row. That's what concerns me. Have you thought that through? Once in a while I understand you'll go 10 hours, but this is 4 days, consecutive days. So I don't know. I'm just kind of worried about particularly the third and fourth day of these men and women that are out there in these construction jobs.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, as I alluded to earlier, I have not done a study or looked at a study that details that information.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Melander, maybe you can help me out here, because what I've been listening to is it sounds like that there's nothing stopping construction companies from currently implementing a 10-hour workday. And, in fact, based on some of the contract the company's comments, it sounds to me like that they maybe even do 12 or 13 hours in some days. And so I'm wondering if that's right. And then secondly, it seems like this bill is trying to make it so Saturday is not an overtime day, and that the scope of this bill is really not about 4 10-hour workdays. It's about cutting wages for workers on construction jobs, and so it's more about saving the contractor money than it is about prevailing wage. Okay, Mr. Chairman, you should tell them not to applaud because we don't.
Well, Senator Thompson, why don't you do that?
I didn't do that for applause line, just so you know. Okay, I used to be the chairman of this committee, and we do have a decorum here where we don't do that kind of stuff, you guys. But thank you anyway. I appreciate it because I don't get applauses very often around here. So, but is that correct, Mr.
Chair, Mr.
Senator,
Senator. I believe that the question was, because I too got distracted because of the applause, because I know that you don't get that very often. The question was, is that do we typically work within the highway industry, work outside of a typical 8-hour day? Is that the question, Senator?
I want to know if there's anything that's stopping.
Okay.
Contractors from doing that right now.
Okay, Chair, to Senator Tomasoni, no, it is not. In the typical workday within the highway industry from time to time is much greater than the 8-hour day. The other question regarding compensation of a premium pay on those days that are indicated as Saturdays and Sundays, this bill would prevent that from happening on Saturday.
Do you have any Jewish members in your? No.
We have, as indicated in my testimony, we have people from all communities and all faiths, we encourage, as I would assume the other committees, that weekends are very important to the family unit, this bill would prevent any type of compensation, additional compensation for working Saturday. So that is correct.
So I'm sensing, Senator Tomasoni, that you might have a slightly different perspective from Ms. Anderson.
In my interpretation, or in our interpretation of the way that this would work, currently Monday, say we have a rain day Tuesday. Okay, Monday is 8 hours of straight time. Tuesday would be not work. Your question was, do people get paid if they show up? No. Tuesday, you would get no pay. Wednesday, you would have 8 hours of straight time. Thursday, you have 8 hours of straight time. And Friday, you have 8 hours of straight time, and Saturday now in a rain day would be straight time. That's in the existing law. Saturday is actually straight time on a rain day week. Then what happens in this law is you would be able to, on Monday you would have 8 hours or 10 hours of straight time. You would rain out Tuesday. So Wednesday you would have 10 hours of straight time, Thursday you would have 10 hours of straight time, and Friday you would have 10 hours of straight time. Saturday would be all overtime under this newly written, the way the new file is at. Currently on a rain week, Saturday is the straight time hours. And that is what forces the contractor to use those, because our budgets indicate that we bid 8 hours of straight time on that dozer this week. So if we don't use that 8 hours for Saturday, then we don't use it at all. So that's it's kind of a little bit confusing that way.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Thompson.
And I think this came from your mouth also, that 10-hour workdays are common.
Very, yes.
And so there's nothing that's stopping you from doing a 10-hour workday now.
Correct, and we do work. We actually, our norm is 11, if you want to know what it is. I mean, Mathwoods Construction works 11 hours on Monday through Friday. That's a normal week.
So then my premise about cutting wages is what this bill is really all about.
No, what we feel it replaces is the additional hotel expense to stay on to Saturdays. There is an expense savings. It's not a wage savings. You are correct.
Mr. Melander, to that point, and then I'm going to ask Senator Dames if he has some concluding remarks, having hit
Chair,
1 o'clock here.
Respectfully, I have, reflecting the testifiers' comment, certified payroll that indicates that their company does have a workforce that randomly works Saturday and Sunday. The current law provides compensation at time and a half over 40 hours, so that can exist right now. And also the comment regarding trying to extend the work week for families, it does not happen in the highway industry. These men and women that are in this room here work Monday through Sunday if, in fact, they have to, and they need to be compensated in a way that supports that. So it's happening right now. As we indicated earlier, this is a wage cut for folks that work in the Minnesota construction industry.
All right, so I have Senator Torres-Ray, and then we'll put a motion on the table. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to go back to a statement that was made, and Mr. Melander. First, I wanted to say there is a tradition in this committee that when a business person, mostly has been men, show up to our committee, we say thank you for your business and thank you for the work that you do for the state of Minnesota. So I want to say that to you. I want to say thank you for the work that you do for the state of Minnesota, and thank you for being here today. But my question is related to a statement that was made with respect to how the system works to get contractors that are based in the state of Minnesota to bid on the contracts and to do the work. And I would like to know, because the statement that was made said that actually the current system works for that, that if we implement this new system that Senator Dames is proposing, we're opening the door to have contractors outside of the state of Minnesota. And I would like to have a clarification on that.
Mr. Melander?
Chair, Senator, I think actually Mr. George made comment to that. I will try to, and I'm not sure if he's still in the word. Okay. So if you want to respond to that.
Mr. George, I'm losing the room here.
Briefly,
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, our opinion is that it is working very well right now. As a testimony indicated, Minnesota workers and Minnesota contractors are doing our jobs in Minnesota. We feel like any tweak to prevailing wage should be taken very seriously. It's a slippery slope. You start doing things like this, and we go in the wrong direction. And then we've seen in other states, the next thing you know, we have contractors here from all over the country, and we don't want to see that.
Thank you.
All right, so Senator Howe moves that Senate File 827 be recommended to pass and move to the Transportation Committee. And I think Senator Dames, given the testimony, there's still some discussion and some work to do on this bill, and that Transportation has asked for it,
yes.
The Transportation Committee. I'm hearing a request for a roll call, so we will honor that. So, Senator Dames, any concluding remarks?
Well, I would just like to thank all the testifiers for coming today and testifying. When you have legislation, you need to hear everybody's voice. And I'd just like to add, I have had folks that, being from rural Minnesota, I have folks that are working for construction companies, and they like the bill because they feel if they're going to get that extra day, they can go do their work in 4 days. They travel away Monday morning, get back. Now Friday, they could get back on Thursday and have some time with their families and stuff. So, like I say, there's always two sides to legislation, and good debate, it makes for good legislation. So thank you for the opportunity to hear the bill.
And thank you, Senator Dames. And let me just put on the record an apology from me to not be able to get to some of the folks who were here for some other legislation. Senate File 2355, which was Senator Nelson's bill, and Senate File 2290. That's an easy one. That's just the deed, folks. And then Senate File 2283, we will get to that. We have a hearing scheduled for tomorrow. We have committee times reserved for Thursday and for Friday, because it's that kind of a week. So I apologize. Yes. That's my bad.
Mr. Chair,
anyone if I've put out of...
Have you sent out those schedules yet for the times for Thursday?
The Wednesday has been notified. The Wednesday schedule's on notice, and then the Thursday and Friday's kind of in the bullpen.
Okay.
But we'll give that to you, Senator Kielash.
We get overtime.
So on... Senator Metzen wants to know if we get overtime for that. I bet we're working more than 10 hours, which is fine. All right. A motion has been made and a request for a roll call. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Michelle.
Yes.
Senator Daley.
Yes.
Senator DeCrye.
Yes.
Senator Dietzick.
No.
Senator Howe.
Yes.
Senator Lilly.
Yes.
Senator Kielash.
No.
Senator Metzen.
No.
Senator Miller.
Yes.
Senator Nelson. Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni.
No.
Senator Torres Ray.
No.
We lost.
So the motion does prevail, there being 7 ayes and 5 nays. So, members, thank you for an extended time. Thank you to the witnesses and for those who came far. Committee is adjourned.
Thank you.
I got a 6.
I saw that.
Didn't have 7 here. 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.